Good morning, everyone. Hopefully we'll have a few people. Hopefully we'll have a few folks find us from room 10 here to room 200. Our change, there are signs on the door, so if you're missing somebody, please consider getting up quickly and running down to 10 and see if they're wandering the halls looking for us. This morning we are going to be talking about poverty, and I want to set the stage for this a little bit to not talk about necessarily what poverty is. We all know what poverty is. We all know how poverty can affect people's lives. But what I wanted to talk about today in particular is that because there's a medical diagnosis involved, with the way that we tie all benefits in this country, and Minnesota is not exempt from doing this, it's all throughout the country, is that we tie all of our benefit plans to our amount of income and our amount of assets. Now, for most things, that's a reasonable, it's a help, it's a support net, it's something that benefits are meant to be able to assist people to move on, if you will, to get from a spot and move on. But what we have found with people who have disabilities is that that option is often not available to move on. And they're stuck in a pattern for their entire life where poverty is their only option. And I think that's wrong. I think as a parent of a child with a disability, that's incredibly wrong. I think that when we spend so much money to educate students through our special education services and the expectation is that they are unable to work, not because they can't work, but because they may lose a health insurance benefit, they may not be able to get to work, there may not be a supportive network for them to be in a job, we're creating this cycle that no one can break from. And I would very much like today to focus on what causes poverty for people with disabilities so that maybe as a legislature we can look at the way that we're addressing this and moving forward to make some corrections in this. But I have to warn, as everybody here in the audience knows, this is not an issue just for Minnesota. This is actually an issue for the United States of America if we are going to employ our populations of people with disabilities. And frankly, we have no option but to. We are looking at a worker shortage in 15 years that is going to require every able-bodied person to be able to hold a job. And we need to be moving our benefits and our supportive networks so that that's the end outcome. Because everybody deserves the dignity and the right to a job. They deserve the dignity and right to have some privacy in their lives. And right now, because of a medical diagnosis, you lose all of that. So that's why the agenda focus this morning is in this format, that we're talking about what some of the effects are and then what can we do to move forward. Where are some of the things that maybe we can look at changing, and then, of course, providing this back out to the legislature next year in a report form so that people understand some of these impacts. So with that, we are very, very lucky this morning. I have not had the privilege of hearing our first testifier, Judge Frank's, testimony, but he has spoken before several committees that I have heard just wonderful feedback from, and I really appreciate him taking time out this morning to come and talk to us. So with it, Judge Frank, if you would like to introduce yourself for the record and then go forward with your testimony. Thank you.
First I'd like to thank you for the invitation, though. Some microphones are not like the professional entertainers. If you get back, you can't sit and talk or sing. So am I being picked up all right here?
You are.
Yeah. All right. I'd like to thank you for the invitation to appear here. I will shortly, once I introduce myself, indicate I think why I think I'm here and why I'm quite certain I'm not here, so it's clear before I give essentially some similar remarks to what I gave to the governor's disability or council on disability, developmental disabilities a few weeks back. My name is first name Donovan, last name Frank. That sounds like it should be inverted, but you'd have to take that up with my mother's father. I'm a farm kid from southern Minnesota who's been very lucky along the way. I grew up in a small town in southeastern Minnesota. Went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. Eventually became a lawyer. And then I'll talk a little, and presently I'm a federal judge, having been appointed by President Clinton 1998, and I won't go into some of the other of my background professionally because I'll touch on that during my remarks, but I will say that I'm privileged to have five daughters. If you see me doing some picking up a little extra work out in the parking lot as you're leaving, it's because I have four in college this year, so and live here in the Twin Cities and have for the last 9 years. A fair question might be, why am I here before this committee? First, I want to be careful to say, as a federal judge for the last 9 years, and as a former state judge for 14 before I was appointed to the federal bench, it's not proper to be here to be lobbying for a particular cause, for a particular issue. I'm prohibited from doing that. I would like to think that I'm here, as much as it sounds like something out of that Disney movie, Pollyanna, that I simply care and have assumed that it's our responsibility to care for the most vulnerable amongst us. But I'm not also here because I deem myself an expert in the area of disability, developmental disability, or in issues of poverty, and I'm certain I don't have the solutions for your committee. Or the answers that you must confront each day. But I am here to discuss my experience with the employment of people with disabilities as it relates to what we're trying to do in the federal court system here in Minnesota. And as long as you don't consider presumptuous of me, because it'll probably be 10 or 12 minutes, I suspect, from here on out, and you can feel free to gavel me at any time, I want to talk about issues relating to disabilities and necessarily poverty because there are far more people with disabilities living in poverty than there are people without disabilities living in poverty. Just say some things that have touched my life along the way that I think bring me here today. I don't know how you can talk about disabilities without acknowledging that it disproportionately affects people with disabilities are disproportionately, I should say, affected by the throngs of poverty. And I'll touch on that because of employment and unemployment issues. I'm quite certain the main reason I'm here is because I tried a major case in federal court some years back with Seamus O'Meara, the president of the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, and then he did a fine job. I was a judge who had the very tragic criminal and civil cases of the Red Lake School shooting. I had all that work a few years back, and he represented all the school district there and others involved. And it was during that time that we were moving out of our permanent federal courthouse to remodeling and spending your tax dollars remodeling the federal courthouse just down the road here a couple blocks. When we started talking about the unemployment and employment problems related to people with disabilities. And so that led me, at his request, to his commission, and he has discussed with me and Chairman Madore, the Chairperson Madore, my coming here. Well, where I begin is, I mentioned I grew up in a small farming community, and that's very important, I think, for me today. My dad was a very smart and insightful man, but he, notwithstanding the fact he was forced to quit school from this very large poor farm family and worked the family farm as an eighth grader. Now, why on earth would I say that to this group of folks here today? Well, I didn't know it then, but from the time I was a little boy until now, my dad insisted when I was a little boy to treat his older second cousin, and that I'll refer to by his nickname Dutch, who was developmentally disabled and who did not have a job, he insisted that we, one, take him to church on Sundays with us, and two, my dad moved off the small family farm and opened up a very small two-employee a TV and appliance store when I was a kid, and he insisted that Dutch work in this store alongside myself and my one younger sister and the two hired help. And so I saw firsthand, I didn't understand why he was doing it as a little kid, but I would then learn later on, and I hold in so much respect my parents as being role models, they were really teaching me that you cannot perpetuate stereotypes of individuals with disabilities or special needs. And while you're not perpetuating that, the only way to really deal with it, what I think does relate to poverty, is to give everyone a fair opportunity to work, to be productive, to have full opportunities, and to live productive lives. And so I grew up without knowing it, my mom and dad doing just that and caring for Dutch and others similarly situated in our community. And because my dad had moved from working from the farm to this small appliance business, something else that he taught me about poverty that didn't relate just to people with disabilities, we would, even though we are a family of modest means, and I just think this goes back again to modeling and how we raise our children these days, he would say there are a group of people in our community who are fine people, and even though they've earned the privilege to get public assistance, nobody will employ them. They're too proud, because they are fine people, to go get the public assistance to which they're entitled to. So Donovan, you're going to take these fruit baskets, turkeys and hams, and you're going to privately and quietly drop them off at their homes. And every holiday, that's what I did until I left for college, and we did it in a very private and unassuming way. And I don't think I understood the effect that that had on me at that time either. Now, before I move on to the whole federal court and employment of disabilities and some other poverty issues, and I want to say this to you with hopefully not a tear in my eye, I was sworn in as a state judge on February 1st of 1985 up on the Iron Range in the 6th District, St. Louis County. My dad was alive then. He was not alive when I took the federal bench in 1998. And he only asked me one thing prior to my being sworn in 1985, and that was this. And it goes back to those early days with Dutch and me growing up. And I've got the quote here. He said, "Did I raise you right, son? Will you be a judge who treats the little guy, the poor guy, and those people most in need the same way as you treat the fat cats and the big influential people that appear in front of you?" End of quote. And I said to my father, "I think you have taught me well, and I'll do my very best." Now, this all reflects on why I'm here today, because I was the first of this large extended family, even though my dad was the youngest son and second youngest of 8 or 9 children, to go off to college. And I didn't understand it then, as what they had taught me in the small community and how they treated people living in poverty, treated people that were disabled. But what I realized after I got a bit more educated and mature, I think, is that, you know what? What they really told me is that the true measure of a civilized and democratic government and society, in the end, is how we treat those people most in need and most vulnerable amongst us. And if we're not treating them with respect and dignity and seeking employment for them, we have really failed as a society and community. Well, moving on to the 70s, I am now a young, ignorant lawyer in northeastern Minnesota, coming out of law school in 1977, and I had an opportunity to serve on the East Range Developmental Achievement Board, which, as some of you may be aware, is and was an achievement center for adults with developmental disabilities. And I would also serve from 1986 until I came to the Twin Cities in 1998 as a member of the Raines Mental Health Center Board of Directors. I know now I was so fortunate to have these advocates for the mentally ill, the advocates for the disabled, the advocates for the poor who didn't have health insurance, because I would sit and have people come in and they would, mothers would have tears in their eyes saying, "You know, I have a disabled son. I've been working, and my social worker told me I should quit work because I'm now ineligible for daycare, and now I'm ineligible for certain health care for my son." And so I would see that happen day in and day out at this Raines Mental Health Center. I was so very fortunate that many parents of disabled children and adults and other advocates sat me down. They must have viewed me as trainable, and taught me about what their struggles were each day. and educated me. In fact, they so educated me that they said it's really a requirement that you're going to start being a volunteer for Special Olympics, and you're going to be working with us in Special Olympics as an advocate. And what I really learned from them is they taught me to challenge the traditional notions of diversity, because I think people forget about those with disabilities and the poverty related to it when they talk about having diverse workforces these days and diverse, whether it's employment, education, or another setting. Fast forward, if I may, to the 1990s. I become chief judge of the 16-judge court in four counties in northeastern Minnesota. And I believe strongly as then chief justice, I went through Peter Popovich, Sandy Keith, Douglas Umdahl while I was in, and they all believed strongly in public outreach programs. So one day I called the then director of special education for the Iron Range Schools, and he was officed in Virginia. His name was Franz Spencer, and I said, you know, Francis, we've been on these staffing teams at the Regional Health Center for years. All these school kids come and participate in mock trials at the courthouse, at the People's Courthouse. Why aren't the special ed kids over here? The adults aren't here with disabilities. The kids aren't here. It's their courthouse, too. I never see them. Well, that's all it took. For the next few months, we had every special education group, every disability group on the Iron Range in my courtroom. And I have a wonderful picture. I brought it to the governor's council. I don't have it here today. In my office of a number of those class settings, because as it turned out, they came with the best questions, they were the best behaved, I learned so much from them, and they were the most interested of all the student groups and adult groups that I had. Mm-hmm. Well, one day a social worker called me and said, we've heard you've been having all the special education groups at your courtroom. Well, I have a large group of adults, some employed, some unemployed, some living in a group home setting, some independently, some in supervised living. They'd like to come to your courthouse. So I said, bring them on over. So, and that's one of my favorite pictures, and I actually still remain in contact with some of those individuals today. So I was talking to them about equal justice under the law under our Constitution, and how it applied especially to all of them. And then privately, one of these social workers approached me and said, there's three adult women here, and they were all developmentally disabled, and they were living in a supervised living situation, and in the case of all three, one had been constantly sexually harassed, one raped, and one sexually abused. And they weren't getting help or attention from any law enforcement agency, at least with appropriate sensitivity and dignity, as I thought. I'll say as a side note that we were able to intervene and address that problem. But I tell you this today because I must admit that I thought I was well-informed, I thought I was educated, and it never crossed my mind, I am sorry to say, until that day, that there's this large group of citizens disproportionately disabled that are subject to sexual harassment, sexual abuse, and other unspeakable indignities, and I didn't realize it until that day when I talked to those women. As they left that day from that class, one of these three women said to me, "Hey, Judge Frank, you keep using the phrase equal justice under the law. Can I tell you what I think it means? Does it mean that I get the same rights even though I'm disabled and the same protection as the president's wife gets in the White House?" And I said to her, that is exactly what it means. But I must say to you that they taught me more that day than I was able to teach them about how to treat people, how to be positive. One comment about my school district here in Twin Cities before I conclude with some remarks about the federal court and the 22 disabled individuals that work with me and clean my chambers, work with me, and that I see every day. I just want to say this about a choir director and an activities director. When we moved here in 1998, and I then at that time my five daughters, where I had two fifth graders, two eighth graders, and a sophomore, because I have two sets of twins, He has a philosophy that irrespective of the physical or mental disability of any student, everybody sings, everybody participates the same as everybody else, no exceptions. And I cannot begin to tell you the influence that this has had on people like my daughters. It has caused them to have different attitudes, to take proactive initiative. They're drivers and mentors for a number of these disabled kids, and it's all because they had a message of inclusion rather than exclusion because of this choir director and the expectations they created in the kids. And I've seen my favorite commencement speech at this public school was by a special ed child. I'm certain he had a lot of help from his mother. I brought tears to my eyes, and it was this message of inclusion by this choir director that everybody participates no matter what. And he challenges every day the notions of diversity in the education setting, and I think if more people did that in the employment setting, we'd be better off. May I have about five more minutes?
Thank you, sir.
I came to the federal court in 1999. Our building has been closed for 2 years. There's two federal courthouses, very unusual, one of a kind situation. Seven federal judges versus, say, 320 state judges, and because we're all lifers. And one courthouse in St. Paul, one in Minneapolis. 22 full-time maintenance janitorial employees who not only did all the maintenance and cleaning in the building, but they were entrusted and are entrusted with everything in our chambers. They have complete access because we're a very kind of security conscious court, all people with disabilities. The General Services Administration, as some of you might be aware, GSA contracts with a couple of organizations. One is called Task Unlimited, which is a not-for-profit 501c3 organization that performs works on long-term employment for persons with disabilities. And so that's who we contract with, and then there's a group called NISH that has its sources, I think, in the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act that hails back to 1971. That was an employment act for people with severe disabilities. I'm certain people in this room know more about than I do. And so it's through those acts that we employ, and not just our courthouse, but across the country. And I'll focus on our situation just for a couple of minutes. And I'll try to like to talk about the human side, what I've seen as it relates to poverty and what happens with employment and unemployment. First of all, I can look you all straight in the face and say all 22 of these individuals are part of what we call our federal family. And that's 22 in St. Paul. There's another larger group in Minneapolis. I observe firsthand and sadly what temporary loss of employment means and the hardships it creates for people with disabilities. Because I learned in watching this that they not, obviously, as many of you know, they rely on the income, as we all do, but the dignity that's associated with being productive in these members of society can't be replaced in an unemployment line somewhere, and it can't give you the quality of life that comes with the productive employment. Actually, it's the people that I work with, this group of 22, that explain to me, you know, does anybody understand when we lose a job that unless there's public transportation and good public transportation, many of the employers we can't work for, even if they're open-minded, proactive employers, because like many people living in poverty and disproportionately people with disabilities, you must be able to drive a car, you must be able to afford to buy a car, insure it, license it, gas it. And so that means that really what if public transportation, and we're pretty essentially restricted in the Twin Cities to the bus service and some limited availability with light rail, unless you're on the bus line somewhere, it's difficult once you lose your job. And so I learned that the hard way as we move into our interim space, which I'll get to in just a moment, because we worked out some other employment in other parts of the Twin Cities, but there was no public transportation. And there may be some other options, but at least that's how it was presented to me. And with the recent statistics, I don't think you understand how many advocates you have out there trying to do the right thing. You probably do. For example, Seamus Amir knew I was coming over here, and he said, you've got to read this Cornell Annual Study Disabilities Status Report so you really understand. And I did take a look at it last night, and so I was thinking of that with these 22 individuals that we employ. And I'll just take Minnesota, where according to that study, they assert that there was a 47% of disabled folks were employed in Minnesota last year versus 85% of the general population, and only 22% of those individuals had full-time work. And so that employment gap between the disabled and the people without disabilities is something I think a lot of people either take for granted or they don't understand. Because we're a diverse workforce, and we do employ as many people, and in our case it's 100% of this particular work crew, I believe that we're a better and stronger workforce and a better court that truly represents the community that we live in. And I think that's the message that needs to go out, and here's how I get it out apart from this committee. When I go out and I speak, and I go into some employers, I won't name any employers by name other than the federal court, and I see people with disabilities that are employed, I seek out a manager and say, I want to thank you for doing the right thing, because you're a better employer and you are a better neighbor if you have a diverse workforce, including hiring people who do great work with disabilities. And so I always seek them out, and I always say, I'll tell everybody I know they should come here. I frankly don't think it's inappropriate for me to say that I do the reverse as well. If I go into a place and I see nobody working with disabilities, I seek out a manager and very respectfully say, you are failing. That's what it means to live in a civil and democratic society. We all are in this together. And I'm going to tell everybody I know that I don't see any type of diversity in your workforce. And in most cases, when I take that approach I'm talking about, I don't see any people with any disabilities working here. Because my experience in the federal court is that, and what these 22 individuals have taught me, not me teaching them, is this. When we've had an employment problem about a task not being done, and I suspect if we've had this, it happens every day, sadly, with private and public employers. It's never been the inability of the disabled employee to do a great job. It's been the lack of training by the person that had no disability who doesn't do the proper training and managing, and they're the people in our court that are held accountable, and we don't permit somebody to blame the lowest person in the organization, which sometimes is, I think, an institutional liability, where I've watched that happen. If people are trained, we've had problems, but it's never been the inability to do the work. It's been improper training in my judgment. I will end with two things. I have learned primarily from working with people with disabilities. They've taught me how to be a better judge. Why on earth would I say that? It's proof that when you treat people with dignity, respect, kindness, and patience, and you work in a diverse setting, that's exactly what litigants and lawyers expect you how to treat them. And so it doesn't make any difference who the person is. They can tell when you care. They can tell when you're patient and kind. That's what I have learned. On that fateful plane crash date, when the lives of Paul and Sheila Wellstone, their daughter and friends, were killed, I was packing up my briefcase in my chambers down the street here a couple blocks, and the same woman with disabilities who's cleaned my chambers for the last 9 years knocked on my door, came in and said, Judge Frank, did you know Paul Wellstone? I said, yes, I did. Cindy, please come into my office. Let me show you a picture of Paul and Sheila and my family after my confirmation hearing in Washington, D.C. And I'll tell the group, so this isn't considered a political speech, also hanging there was a picture of my family and I with Senator Rod Grams, because the two of them were very big and let me speed through during a difficult time my confirmation process. So I showed her the picture of Paul Wellstone, and she said to me as follows, "Judge Frank," and I've got the quote here, "is it true what people are saying about Senator Wellstone, that he represented poor people and people on welfare and I guess all sorts of people who need help?" I said, "That's true." She then asked, then she said this to me, "That means that he represented me and people like me, does it not?" As a tear or two came down my cheek, because I knew quite well the Wellstones, that I don't think she saw, I said, "You know, Cindy, yes, it's true. You've got it right. Paul Wellstone cared for you and did his best to represent you." When we moved out of the building where we are now, just across the street, we did everything we could to leverage the new private landlord to hire all 22 individuals so they could come with us. In fact, I suggested we not agree to the contract unless they agreed to bring everybody along. So some were able to come, some didn't. We were able to get work for everyone else elsewhere. But in the future, GSA has promised us that when there's an inner move like this, they will consider making the condition of the contract for a prospective landlord, that instead of just bidding things out, that unless you hire disabled individuals as part of your workforce, and that includes bringing our own folks along, we don't enter into contracts with people who don't do such things. An issue for another day, as I since I've gone way over my time, and I apologize. An issue for another day is the willingness of unions and businesses in collecting bargaining agreements, because that's an issue that came up in our situation, to contain hiring and retention provisions requiring the hiring of qualified people with developmental disabilities. Because that was an excuse that was used when we went to hire. They said, "Well, this union that has all these people working in this building, they don't hire people because they don't meet the qualifications." And my response is, then we have an obligation, whether it's a vendor in the state capitol building, whether it's a vendor or a good job in a professional setting, that we have an obligation to look at those issues and say, just don't bid it out to the cheapest bidder, because we have an obligation to provide a diverse workforce, and it should be included somewhere in a CBA or other contract. And if it's not, then we are failing the oath that I took, that we are to provide equal justice under the law, and we should practice what we preach. I'm sorry for taking more of your time than should. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Doug.
I don't have any questions of me. I don't have any answers for you. But.
Are there any questions, Doug? Well, thank you so very much for coming in today. Very
can I just
appreciate
leave you
it.
One thing, if I may? And I'll promise to get away so you don't battle me. Right when we were moving out and I was viewed as a troublemaker because I was insisting that we bring everybody along, I had a federal supervisor come into my office, not from the federal court, because if it had been from the federal court, they'd no longer be employed there, frankly. But, and she said to me, "Why do you care so much about these disabled people? You're going to get real employees over at this new facility." I said, "Excuse me?" I said, "You know, I think it's time to leave. The only thing you've taught me is that my mother and father raised me wrong, I guess." Because I said, this was never about seeing who can get the cheapest and the best cleaning. It's about hiring people who do the work, providing a quality of life to people, giving us a diverse workforce. It was never really about finding the cheapest contract, regardless of the consequences. But I'm afraid that may be a thought that many people have. So thank you very much. Good luck to your to very important committee. So
thank you.
Let me know if there's anything we can do. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're on my short list. Yes, all thank
right.
you. So next we have Joan Wilshire, who will be giving us an overview right now of the current status of people with disabilities here in the state. Mm-hmm. If you can identify yourself with the tape and then. Not a real accessible spot, is it?
No, it's
okay, well, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Joan Wolfsire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and I'm here today to give you a brief overview of people with disabilities in poverty. And just a brief note, the Council on Disability exists as your advisory entity on disability issues. We advise governors, state legislatures, state agencies, and the public regarding disability issues. In August of this year, the Minnesota State Demographer, Tom Gillespie, he had testified at the Commission to End Poverty on August 2nd, and he stated what we in the disability community all already know, and that is people with disabilities make up the largest percentage of Minnesotans living in poverty. In fact, almost 40% of impoverished Minnesotans have a disability. He also mentioned that having a disability is a characteristic that increases a person's likelihood of living in poverty in Minnesota. Today I'm going to explain in detail why people with disabilities make up such a large percentage of Minnesotans who live in poverty. I'll give an overview of disability statistics, then we'll discuss some specific issue areas that impact people with disabilities' lives and why they end up living in poverty. Many of these issues overlap or provide conflicting incentives, compounding the problems facing people with disabilities and making it more difficult to get out of poverty. The realities facing Minnesotans with disabilities are very hard. It may appear to some that we are a population that is very much devalued. But what I want you to go away with today are the realities of what people with disabilities face every day in their life when living in poverty. Briefly, I do want to touch on what a definition of disability is so everybody knows what we're talking about. And briefly, it's having a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities, walking, breathing, caring for oneself, if you have a record of such impairment and are regarded as just having an impairment. And keep in mind, too, there's different standards and definitions of disability. In our office, we traditionally, and many agencies, use the Americans with Disabilities Act standard of definition of disability. But keep in mind, though, with this, that many of the statistics I'm giving you, they do use varying degrees of different definition of disability. General statistics. You can see here that almost not quite 600,000 Minnesotans are reported as having at least one type of disability. 6% of Minnesotans reported having two or more types of disabilities. 17% of Minnesotans with disabilities live in poverty. Pretty significant. While only, you know, not quite 8% of the non-disabled Minnesotans live below the poverty level. And this data does not include people living in group homes and housing. So you can see that people with disabilities are pretty underreported in these statistics. The poverty rate according to disability type, I think, is very interesting. As you can see right in the middle, people with mental disabilities, and what they mean by mental disabilities are difficulty learning, remembering or concentrating, having slightly higher rates of poverty, they will have slightly rates of poverty than people with physical disabilities. So I think people sometimes, I think, fail to realize that the non-visible conditions sometimes are more at greater risk of being in poverty. A person with an employment disability is one that has difficulty working at a job or a business. And then, of course, a person with a go-outside-the-home disability is someone who cannot leave his or her home alone to shop or even visit a doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
So I really think these areas really show quite a bit in terms of what folks with disabilities are looking at in terms of poverty. As we continue here with some more general stats, in 2007, the federal benefit rate was around $623, and the max, this is the maximum SSI cash assistance one can receive. In December 2006, the Minnesota average was around, for SSI, $462. And in Minnesota, in 2005, the SSI benefits were only 17% of the median one-person income. So really what this means is that the person with a disability is able to live solely off of SSI benefits will be only earning 17% of what the median one-income Minnesotan earns. So keep in mind when you're looking at these figures that a person has to use this dollar amount to pay their rent, you know, groceries, medical co-pays, transportation, or maybe a movie if they're really, really lucky and budget well.
Just one quick.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why the 462 versus the 623?
Which one are you looking
at? Minnesota federal benefit is 462.
Which one are you looking at?
The slide you're just on is the federal benefit you said is 623. That's the max.
Right.
In Minnesota, the average is 462.
Right.
Slide 6, I'm sorry, yeah.
Why is there a difference there?
Just people don't qualify for the whole benefit, or
right? That's a good. I'm going to have to ask a good question, Madam Chair and the committee members here. I work with my interns on coming up with these numbers, so that could be a typo error here.
Okay.
That I can't recall right off the top of my head here.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wolfe, you say the federal benefit is 623 maximum. Do you know what other states receive as far as, is there other, another comparison that you can make there between?
Madam Chair, committee members, at current, I don't have those with me right now. No, I don't. I can certainly get those to you if that's something you like.
Thank you.
Any other? Go on, then.
Okay.
Looking
at 2004 and 2006, people with disabilities who relied on SSI as their source of income started descending even further into poverty. This is according to the price out reports that we've been using as a lot of our good data here. And it just goes on to say in 2006, the annual income of a single individual receiving SSI payments was around $7,500, again, equal to around 18% of the national median income for a one-person household. What I'm going to be looking at in the next couple of slides here are actual specific issue areas that now impact people with disabilities' ability to either prevent going into poverty or even getting out of poverty. Some of the next slides will touch on this. Here. Education. This slide, I really want you to pay attention to the dollar amount here as we move forward and talking to the next issue areas. We're looking at about $5.5 million are spent on tuition and support services for consumers, which is around 2,500 consumers receiving these services. There's a lot of money to be spending on educating people. So as they say, keep this dollar amount in mind as we're looking at these next slides. Employment. In 2005, we're looking at the employment rate for Minnesotans with disabilities aged 21 to 64 was around 45%. Only 26% worked full-time. And as you can see in the parentheses here, it's comparing that to around 84% for Minnesotans without disabilities. Rather interesting. In 2005, the percentage of Minnesotans with disabilities aged 18 to 64 that were looking for work was around 9%. Here again, comparing this to the 4% for Minnesotans without disabilities. Again, we're spending a lot of money looking at the previous slide, educating people with disabilities. And some might say we're doing a lot of graduating folks from universities, colleges, vocational settings, and so forth, and graduating them right back onto the sofa because they're not becoming employed.
Representative McCrone?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, when you're talking education, are you talking after a certain age, post-secondary, or are you talking birth?
That's post-secondary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ms. Wolfe.
Madam Chair and committee members, I was hoping I'd have a figure for the K-12 and was not able to get that before this hearing here this morning. Let's see here. Moving on to the next slide here, continuing on talking about employment. Let's see, in 2005, the average Minnesotan without a disability earned around $31,000, while the average Minnesotan without a disability earned around $16,000. So you're looking at a 50% difference here in terms of what folks are making with and without disabilities. And so I think here again, when you're looking back to the slide on education and employment, we need to be really seriously looking at how we're educating folks, and then are they actually using their education to gain employment. Moving to the next issue area that impacts poverty.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me on the persons with disabilities level of employment, you have the number of $16,502. Is that in addition to or supplemental of the SSI payments? Would these same individuals be getting the SSI payment and income, or not necessarily?
Madam Chair, committee members here, representative, that I would not, the source that we, as you can see where we obtain this information is, I don't have that information to know if it was broken out by that. I really don't.
Ms. O'Pine, would you like to come and answer that question? We may have an answer here. And if you could identify yourself, please, for record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Roberta Olpin, the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I'm not sure I can directly answer the question, but I can give some context, I believe. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it is my understanding that when you are on SSI or SSDI and become employed, you can earn a certain amount of income. After that, as your income goes up, the SSI and the public funds go down. And I'm not just sure where those breaking numbers are. There's also a program that says you can stay on MA for a period of time. But again, once your income reaches a certain level, then you lose all public benefits.
Thank you. I hope that helps.
Yes?
Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'd like to respond to that a little
bit. Could you identify yourself?
A little more information. Rick Cardenas from Advocating Things Together. There is a program, a Social Security program, a federal program called Program for Self-Support. It's 1619B, where the individual, if they have a disability and they go through this program, they, it's probably not as well known as it should be, but it allows a person to earn the same amount of money, or at the threshold is that they receive services for. So if you receive medical assistance services to $100,000, that's your limit on how much you can make. So that program is a self-support program that many organizations did not take advantage of, but it's a real difficult thing to get into also. So there are methods, but it's really difficult to try to do that.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. I think we'll move to the next slide. And keep in mind, I'm doing real general. There's specific programs. We can certainly come back at some point and talk about employment, because there's certainly other programs that can speak to how you can, as we'll get further into my presentation, about seeking benefits and so forth, and being able to work and so forth. But I'm doing just a real general overview, not being specific, but would be glad to come back at another time to be more specific on some of these issues. But let's move forward and talk about transportation, and because this does impact how a person with disability can gain employment and just be a productive citizen here. Almost 50 million people in the U.S. have difficulties in getting the transportation they need. Of these, nearly 6 million, or 40%, are people with disabilities. And more than 3.5 million here, as you can see in the U.S., never leave their homes. And this kind of goes back again to that slide that we saw about the folks that aren't able to get out. And of these, it's about 1.9 million that are, you know, people with disabilities. And that's that 54% number that you'll see that the ADA has always used about how many people with disabilities exist in the U.S. And approximately 560,000 persons with disabilities, again, do not leave their homes specifically because they cannot access the transportation they need. I did submit to Jennifer here the other day, and the testimony on Lily, a person here, again, with significant disabilities, can't use some of the transportation here in Minnesota as a result of her physical disability. And during the winter months, we'll spend months, weeks, not able to even get out to go anywhere as a result of this condition. So there are people that it does certainly exist for them, this issue. The next slide here, as we call it, transportation is not a problem unless you want to go somewhere. This is a common saying in the disability community, unfortunately. The most prominent difficulty here is, you know, traveling outside the home. It's a lack of a personal vehicle. I don't know anybody in the room here that probably even thinks twice about that, probably. You just get in your car and you go. You know, others included in this public transportation, you know, is cost, certainly, and then physical problems that make up the transportation difficulty, and then personal preferences, just like all of us. How often do we see ads for taking the bus or light rail, and we choose not to because we like the freedom of getting in the car and being able to go somewhere. Also, you know, people with disabilities may not be able to afford in an automobile, because once you do that, if one requires some of the physical adaptations, the modifications are quite expensive. So the vehicle modifications and so forth basically are a huge obstacle for many people with disabilities. And for some people, it's just easier to obtain general transportation than it is to be obtaining a personal vehicle. Looking at public transportation in Minnesota, as we know, there's 87 counties in Minnesota, and out of the 87, only 66 of them have a countywide public transportation. Seven counties in Minnesota do not have public transportation, which means accessible non-emergency transportation is not available for seniors or people with disabilities. So, and you can see there what the counties that are listed there in parentheses. For people with disabilities who are not able to afford a car or who cannot drive on their own, if public transportation is not available, people with disabilities have no way of getting to jobs that they may have or want to seek out. So again, this is another reason why poverty will continue. There is another little short story of a person that called their office this summer, a gentleman in the northern suburbs that was had found employment to work a couple days a week. The gentleman has MS and uses a scooter, but could only get within 2 to 3 blocks of the actual employment because transportation services couldn't get them any further because it crossed county lines. So we worked on over a month, trying to get this gentleman someone to pick him up at this one drop-off point to get him those 2 blocks to the actual job. You know, in the summer, he could easily scoot those 2 blocks with his scooter. A day like today might be a bit brisk, and by Saturday with our snow falling would be really quite a challenge. So I don't know of any other population that really goes through something like that in thinking of transportation, how to get somewhere.
Representative Ward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wilshire, of the 56 counties that have public transportation, do you know how many of them have accessible transportation, public transportation, like, you know, 24/7 or Isn't that a real problem as well? It only is specific times and days and right. things like that?
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Ward, absolutely. Other than the metro area, that, trust me, the outstate areas do not have the 24/7 availability. So your most common is Monday through Friday, the 8 to 4:30 type of scenario, is if you're lucky. If you're very lucky. So the quality of life in the outstate area for people with disabilities is quite a bit different than those in the metro area. Thank you. Okay, keep moving here. So we can, so that kind of talks a little bit about the transportation. I think the next issue we want to go over is housing, because housing plays a huge impact of, you know, where we're going to be able to work, perhaps, that we'd like to live relatively close to where we work. And in 2000, we can see here that people with disabilities were the low-income group with the highest levels of unmet need for housing assistance, and that there were no housing markets in the country, no housing market in the country existed where a person with a disability receiving SSI benefits could afford to rent a modest deficiency or one-bedroom apartment. So even if someone earns enough money, working or has, you know, money, assets, whatever, saving for a house could jeopardize their eligibility for, you know, other life needs like health care. So, you know, the cycle kind of keeps going on and on here. I think this next slide on housing is even more interesting, of looking at in 2000 for the first time, the national average of rent for a one-bedroom in efficiency units. Were more than the entire monthly income of an individual nationally, which is around 113%. And in Minnesota, you can see we're at 90%. So at least in Minnesota, you'll have maybe a little bit of money. You'll be able to choose whether to eat or buy your co-pays for your drugs. But I don't know if there'll be enough money to also get to be able to, so you can pick up your co-pays or your food. So that one is, it's going to be a challenge here. I think it's just interesting here as we're moving forward here, looking at what we have to spend our money on. The next slide here talks about people with disabilities can't save for bigger purchases. As I had stated earlier, there are just too many asset limits. The next speakers here this morning will be talking about spend downs and asset limits. I won't be getting into that, but I think it's important here in this price out report that we were using here for our research, talked about how important the median income is in looking at housing policy, because they stated it's actually an indicator that most government housing programs use to determine eligibility requirements that, you know, basically just relate to the income. So, you know, what you make does determine where you're going to live and how you're going to live. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Wolfe, since SSI and some of these benefits are from the federal level, what's the consensus of the Congress regarding allowing these limits to be lifted to allow them to save or get more money and put it aside versus saying you're stuck at this situation here and there's no more that you can do?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative, certainly we don't do a great deal of work, you know, on the national level. We certainly watch it and so forth. But, you know, there's no movement and not a great deal of movement of any kind, you know, seeing an increase of, you know, income, SSI, et cetera. So I think that's one of the things you're seeing kind of a flavor here, is that something needs to happen, you know, not only, you know, statewide, but federally, you know, to lift and allow some relief for people with disabilities in particular. Okay. Let's see here. It's often said that, you know, answer to the housing affordable gap for people with disabilities is employment. Let's just get them a job. Well, here again, the National Housing Wage data makes it clear that when people with disabilities move from the SSI program to employment, many are still likely to experience housing affordability problems. So, you know, money is great and employment is good, but the point is, it goes back to the other slide when we looked at the salary ranges, we're still making half of what the non-disabled population is, so we can't ever get ahead, is what I think the little flavor of that whole scenario is. So. And of course, we want to move forward, and we can't overlook health care, because you have to have your health to be able to hopefully work and to, you know, afford to be able to, you know, look at a lot of good things like housing and et cetera. I'm just touching briefly on some of the health care. One of the other testifiers will look at a little bit more on this particular area, but certainly Medicare does not cover a lot of the needed services for people with disabilities. You know, the long-term care, dental care, and hearing aids, more areas and dollar coverage are needed in that area. Around, you can see 22 million of people with disabilities experience at least one secondary condition per year. This is huge. There's no reason why you're allowed just one disability in life. You may have more than one. There's no law or regulation saying one is not enough. 60% of the secondary conditions could be prevented, and I think this is very interesting. If all people with disabilities participated in health promotion programs, this could save $40 billion per year. And then, as we all know, in 2005, the Medicare Part D was implemented, forcing many populations to pay a monthly premium that they've never, ever had to pay before, which is anywhere between $35 and $50 a month. So, here again, go back to do your simple math of that $600-some a month they're paying, and 90% of that's going to your, you know, your housing, and then now, oh, by the way, you got to pay for that Medicare Part D program, too. So, anyway, so these stats show you there's many frustrations that people with disabilities go through just to obtain good health care. The individual market coverage is inadequate, as we all know, and it's unaffordable. And certainly more than half of all the non-elderly people with severe disabilities are covered by private health insurance, so this is not good. And the high unemployment limits also access limits the access to employer-sponsored health insurance programs as well. And medical assistance, here again, this is an area I'm not going to be spending a great deal of time on either, as one of the other testifiers will be addressing this area, but this medical, the spend downs, the asset limits and eligibility requirements for the medical assistant area certainly plays a huge impact on why people with disabilities are impoverished. The cost-related barriers to care for people with disabilities, I think, is another one that we shouldn't be saying, gosh, I couldn't understand that. Well, again, with the small dollar amounts that we have to use, you can only see why 46% of the folks went without something they needed. Well, do the math. It's just not enough funds if things aren't being covered. And then, again, looking at the things that they actually postponed, from doctor care, splitting the pills, I think this all makes sense when you're looking at what's happening with people with disabilities and the, you know, you force someone into a corner that they've only got so much to be able to use. So these barriers alone will continue to keep people stuck in poverty, or at least start heading them down that slippery path, which is not good. Yep,
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Wilshire, the study that you got here, the graph, is that a national study, or is that just a statewide or regional study? It doesn't really, just says the Kaiser Family Foundation. I'm not sure where that is, where's the located.
This last slide, the Kaiser Family Foundation?
Yes.
That is a national.
National study.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how many people were studied in that case, in this case, or surveyed?
Could you repeat that, please?
Do you know how many people were surveyed in this?
I do not. I wouldn't have that handy. Is that something you'd like me to get back to you on? I
appreciate that.
Okay. Can do. And just, you know, in summary here, you know, you can see in many instances the reliance, you know, there's huge reliance here on government benefits. You know, we basically, in a nutshell, we sentence people with disabilities to a lifetime of poverty just based on all the federal laws and state laws that we have to work within. Many of the systematic barriers remain. We need to be looking at improving the areas of housing, transportation, healthcare, and employment. All these areas, it's not just one, all of these impact why people with disabilities live in poverty and will continue to do so in the future. This really concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to answer any questions, and thank you for the opportunity today. We appreciate having this committee to be able to talk about the issues in the disability community.
Thanks very much, Ms. Wilshire.
Questions?
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, now we're going to have a presentation. I don't see, I don't know. Yeah, moving on. Okay, actually, it might be a good time. Is Barb Smith here? Oh, Barb, would you come down and do a presentation now on SSI and SSDI? It's a little confusing. For people, we have a variety of programs here we're talking about, and it might be helpful to have your overview now. Again, thank you for coming on such short notice. I'm very appreciative of you being here today.
You're welcome.
You can identify yourself for the record. And then do you have a handout for us? Or
I'm sorry, I do not.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee and community members, I am Barb Smith. I am the director of the Minnesota Work Incentives Connection. And we are a former pilot project of the Social Security Administration that was housed for 8 years with the Department of Employment and Economic Development Rehab Services Branch. On October 1st of this year, we passed our one-year anniversary as a nonprofit agency working with people with disabilities. And the job that we do is we provide answers to people about the impact of work on their government benefits with the hope that people with disabilities can see some options and choices and take advantage of some of life's opportunities. And because I did have little time to prepare, I apologize for not having a handout. And at this time, I thought I would speak just generally about the process and how it starts for a person with a disability getting benefits and then leads up to these very confusing questions about how benefits are impacted by working. And I thought I would look at this from the perspective of many of the people that we serve and the things that are sometimes said to them or things that happen as they begin this journey through the government benefit system. And it's true that when a person is born with a disability, by the time they get to age 18, or if a person becomes disabled sometime during their adult life, unless a family has a great deal of income and assets, those individuals and their family members are likely to end up on some combination of government benefits. And oftentimes people believe we give these benefits to just anyone who asks for them. We offer these benefits to people who probably really don't need them. And so I wanted to start by talking a little bit about that. To get Social Security benefits at the federal level, people have to prove they have a physical or a mental condition that is going to exist for at least 12 months and or is going to result in their death. And they have to prove that that condition is going to keep them this year in 2007 from earning more than $900 at a job. That's tough criteria to prove, and it takes a long time to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. If we look at our state-administered benefits, if people are going to apply for those, generally your income is going to be compared to the federal poverty guidelines. And if you are not in the neighborhood of poverty, you are likely not going to be eligible for those benefits. So I say that, first of all, just to start with the whole notion that we don't just hand these benefits off to anyone who says that they have a disability. People have to prove it. The other thing that people go through is a rather rigorous application process. And I think a lot of times people shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, people have to fill out forms. That's to be expected. But I think it is a very daunting and difficult process for an awful lot of people. And I just heard a story from a friend of mine that I thought I would use here. This friend of mine, and I'm going to call her Sally, works for the Social Security Administration, and she's worked for them for 30 years. Highly competent person, an excellent advocate for people with disabilities, and she's worked in all corners of that agency. So she knows all of the policies and procedures, up and down and back and forth. Her daughter's mother-in-law has multiple sclerosis, and she's watched this woman struggle to maintain a full-time job in order to keep her health care. And as the disease has progressed and she has rapidly deteriorated physically, the doctor finally said, you know, you can't continue to do this. So she has to apply for Social Security benefits. And my friend Sally said to her, well, you know, that's okay. I'll help you. No problem. We'll get this done. And after going through that process, Sally called me and she said, gosh, Barb, I don't even believe this. I went through this process with her, filling out my agency's forms, and it was horrendous. It required so much history, so much work. It exhausted me. This is my agency. I know why they're asking these questions. It was difficult. And she said, when I get done with this job, I want to get out there and help people apply for benefits because it's one of the worst parts of the process that I can tell. So I think that's very telling about how rigorous and difficult it is to be faced with those forms and those applications, usually at a time when you are feeling your very, very worst. And so it, just a comment there about what people go through to get benefits. Now, once people are on benefits, and Joan has talked a little bit about this, I'm going to try to frame it up in very simple scenarios. If I am a person who was born with a disability, or I become disabled pretty early in my life and I haven't paid much into the Social Security system, I'm likely going to end up being eligible for the Social Security program called Supplemental Security Income, SSI. SSI is a means-tested program, which means you need to be poor to get on the program, and we like to say you have to stay poor to retain the benefits of that program. SSI was created in 1970 to really provide just a minimum floor of income for people with disabilities and for people who were elderly, who had not worked during their lifetime. In 2007, as Joan noted, that floor, the monthly floor for a single person, is $623. Now, generally, people will also get some state-administered benefits to go along with that. A single individual living alone will get Minnesota Supplemental Aid, MSA, of $81. They're likely to get $10 of food support, and they will get medical assistance with copays, no premium for other costs associated with that. So this individual has $714 a month to live on. If they are very, very lucky, because housing is a whole other topic here today, but if they are able to get subsidized housing, they're going to pay only 30% of their income for housing, which leaves $500. And the $500 is for utilities, phones, and I'm separating phones from utilities because we find a number of people on SSI who do not have phones. They cannot afford them. Nutritious food, not mac and cheese, but actually nutritious food, medication copays, transportation, some clothing, and perhaps the internet. If I want to be on the computer, perhaps a subscription to the newspaper. Maybe I can buy a couple of books to read if I enjoy doing that. I'm not living with a lot of dollars to work with. That's the person on SSI who is only receiving benefits. That's kind of the picture for them. For an individual who's worked enough to pay into the Social Security system, they're likely going to be eligible for Social Security Disability, insurance, or what we call SSDI. The average SSDI benefit paid in 2007 was $900 a month. Now, some people who have extraordinarily high earnings over a long period of time could be receiving a higher Social Security check than that average of $900. But I think it's really important to note that no one ever receives a check from Social Security Disability that comes even close to what they were earning prior to becoming disabled. And in fact, Social Security was never created to replace people's income 100%. So if we take an example, yes,
Representative Norton. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wondered if you could answer that question that had come up based on what you just said earlier about why Minnesota's average was only $423 as opposed to the $623, which is the floor.
My guess on that would be that when people who are on SSI begin to work, their benefit check will begin to gradually decrease. So probably if you average the people who are working, that's one of the answers. And the other answer is if you're a person who is receiving housing and perhaps food from a parent or a relative, you will not be eligible for that full $623. So I think when you put that together, that's probably how the average comes out lower.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Now, if I can do kind of an example of a person who becomes eligible for SSDI and kind of look at their general financial situation. If we have a single person who's earning, let's say, $3,000 a month, and they become disabled, they will likely be eligible for an SSDI payment of $1,000. So this person has quickly had their income decrease from $36,000 a year to $12,000 a year. Now, if this is me, with that money, with that $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year, I've got to think about paying my mortgage. Likely, I won't be able to keep my house. Mm-hmm. I have utilities, phone, transportation, co-pays, deductibles, and premiums if I'm lucky enough to be able to afford to stay on my employer's COBRA program. I have food and I have clothing, and clearly my standard of living has changed substantially. The point of just offering these two very basic scenarios is to say that people do not achieve some kind of financial advantage by being disabled or becoming disabled and receiving benefits. People will tell you that they don't like getting benefits. Most people will say, and I quote, "I hate the fact that I have to receive benefits." In the same breath, people will tell you, "Thank God for these benefits, because without them, I don't know what I would do." It is, these benefits are a safety net, and that's all they are. Because now if you tack up the federal poverty level for a single person this year, you have $10,212. When we look at our person who is receiving SSI, their annual income is $8,568. They're on benefits. We're proud of ourselves for helping them out. They are almost $1,700 below the poverty level. Now, we might say that person on SSDI is luckier because their annual income is $12,000, so they're a couple thousand dollars over the federal poverty guideline. Tell that to me when my income has gone from $36,000 a year to $12,000. I'm not feeling very lucky. So I think that government benefits give people a minimum subsistence of living. They don't allow people to live high on the hog. They don't give people a rosy future long term. And so with this picture that I've painted, you know, what's the answer? So if we make the point that people with disabilities live in poverty, what are we going to do? The Social Security Administration did a study some time ago, and perhaps someone has already talked about that this morning. And in the study, it was noted that approximately 85 to 88% of the people with disabilities who were interviewed indicated that they wanted to work. And then when Social Security looked at the percentage of people in this country who actually work, who have disabilities, I believe it was less than 20%. Don't quote me on that because I couldn't find the study as I was preparing for this. But it was a very big contrast in people saying they want to work and people actually working. So we might say to ourselves, well, this is America, And work is the way you get ahead in this country. And so why doesn't everybody just get a job? And I think Joan also alluded to that. Just get a job and maybe things will be better. I want to say a few things about that. We have complications. There are complicating factors. People who want to work, some of them are too ill and too frail to be able to work. We have, as Joan already pointed out, some serious transportation issues, even in the Twin Cities, where people would say we have a large transportation infrastructure. We have people that cannot get themselves to where the jobs are and cannot get themselves home at night, particularly if they're working an evening shift. The buses are no longer running. We have discrimination by employers. We're a little uncomfortable having these people with disabilities around. Maybe they're going to cost us more money. Might be best to hire somebody else. We have lots of beginning level minimum wage jobs. Those are not going to move a lot of people out of poverty. There simply aren't enough dollars there. Benefits can quickly decrease as a person starts working, making it incredibly difficult to replace that minimum level of benefits with income, let alone to actually move yourself ahead financially. And then as I think your questions were raised during Joan's presentation, benefits programs are incredibly confusing. The rules don't match with each other as you move across programs. People have worked hard to get on benefits, and people are very fearful about going to work, losing benefits, and potentially being worse off financially and losing health care. So we see a lot of people at the Connection who do want to work. They are very interested in it. They have a lot of energy around it. They ask us some very complex questions. I cannot afford to lose my health care. What are we going to do if I go to work? Health care is my lifeline. Without it, there is nothing else. Am I really going to be better off financially? You know, people with disabilities are going to make decisions like all of the rest of us, which is, if I make this decision, if I take this action, what is the benefit to myself and to my family? I'm going to make a practical decision about that. I haven't worked for 3 or 4 years now. I've been going through all this rehabilitation. Can I really maintain a job, even a part-time job? And there's a lot of self-esteem and psychological factors that play into that question. What if I take a job and I get much sicker? What if I make my disability worse? What if I lose my benefits and then I lose my job? Then what happens? What do I live on? Can I work enough to give up these benefits? And the bigger question, can I get my former life back? So those are very serious, very huge questions that people are faced with. So it's not surprising that people see going to work as a risky business, as something that really is going to take a lot of thought. And this is where the Connection comes into play. We offer services to people to help them answer some of those questions and to understand how their benefits are going to be impacted by working. Before the existence of the Connection, a person who wanted to go to work would need to talk to Social Security. They need to talk to a financial worker. They might need to talk to a housing contact. And those people, hopefully, would give them information about how their benefits would change. And hopefully that information would be accurate information. And there would be this pile of information that was confusing, that was conflicting, because our benefits programs don't run in sync with each other in terms of rules. And people would sit down and look at all of this and say, I can't do it. I worked with people who had mental health disabilities for 20 years before I got involved with the Connection. And people would just be so overwhelmed. They'd just say, I'm not going to work. I saw people make that decision. And it makes sense. I'm going to make a major life decision, and I don't understand the implications of what I'm deciding. It immobilizes people. And so people may decide not to work even though maybe working is the way to begin to be better off financially. In 1999, the connection started, and our purpose was really to serve as a one-stop shop for people to get information about all of their government benefits and the impact on those benefits of different levels of earned income. Our goal was to provide accurate information, because if you talk to people in the disability community, they'll tell you, you can call three different people with Social Security and you'll get three different answers. And who am I supposed to believe? So we want to make the information accurate, and we want to make it understandable to that individual. There's lots of pamphlets out there. You can go on a website and read to your heart's content. But if it isn't in the language that you understand, and that applies individually to your life circumstances, you're not going to have a good grasp of the implications of going to work. We look at and show people their financial bottom lines, working versus not working, working at different levels. We look at health care. We look at what safety nets are available. And we make people aware of all of the things available to them or that could happen to them given their individual circumstances. Our job is to give people the facts. Our job is to point out to them where there are real risks in the decision they're making and where the perceived risks are really misinformation that's been passed around. There are safety nets for people in certain circumstances, and there's no harm, no foul if you try to work a job. Where we want to go with people is to get people to a place where they're making an informed and a confident decision about going to work, using accurate information and then their own individual factors in terms of what they need, how their health is, etc. I didn't have time today to show you, and as I think about it now, I regret that I didn't pull some of our benefits analysis work. Because what we would do is take that person on SSI that we talked about earlier who wasn't working, and this person would want to go to work, and we'd say, okay, how much do you think they're going to make? Let's put in $600. Let's try $800. Let's try $1,331, which this year happens to be the point at which your SSI check will go to zero. And let's see what happens to each one of your benefits. Let's see how your rent changes, and let's look at your bottom line. And I'd love to come back and show you that at some point. The same thing with people on Social Security disability benefits. You can take people through kind of scenarios and show them when and where and how benefits could change. And oftentimes, what a benefits analysis will show is that you can lose benefits and still be better off for working. And that's a shocking piece of information, given what people have been told and given how frightened and fearful people can be about going to work and really messing up their benefits. They've been warned against doing that. That is what we do for each of the people that we serve. We provide the benefits analysis. Most of the time, people are going to be better off financially for working. Not everybody. Not everybody can work. Many people can only work part-time, which means they're also going to remain on some benefits. Some people are going to work off Social Security benefits, but they're going to need that medical assistance in order to cover major medical and health problems that they have because of their disability. The fact is, unfortunately, that even if a person with a disability goes to work part-time, we'll generally see that their standard of living will be better. They could be several hundred, maybe $500 ahead of where they started. But if we go back and compare that number to the federal poverty level, we haven't gotten people to the point where they can lift themselves up out of poverty and move on with the rest of their lives. Benefits drop away too quickly when people start to work. People are not able to make enough money in income to replace the benefits before the benefits are gone. So I'm not better off for working. Disabilities fluctuate. People can work for a while, but then they need to fall back on benefits because they're not able to work for a period of time.
and people with disabilities are often not in a position, for a number of reasons, to access some of the high-paying jobs that would allow them to move off benefits and allow them to move into a substantial standard of living. And I did not want to get into the logistics of each benefit program and how they're impacted by working today, because we could take 3 hours to go through some of those scenarios. It is a very overwhelming and complex job. We spend, I have 9 staff, spending all of their time working with people, explaining that to them. So part of what we've done is created a system where we help people by providing benefits. We make it then sort of difficult for people to figure out how to move beyond those systems and make things better for themselves by working. And so in close here, because I'm probably running on, I just want to say that as you continue to look at these issues, a couple of things. What you're talking about is just so critically important to so many people. And I assume that everybody knows folks who have disabilities. And I don't want to be morbid, but I do have to say, working in this field, we know that all of us in this room are potentially seconds away from becoming disabled ourselves. And I think of a fellow Howard that I talked to last week. And he's a fella in his early 50s. He's got 2 kids in college, a house, a wife who's a nurse. He's been working full-time his entire adult life. And he was having trouble with his eyes, and he went to his eye doctor. And the eye doctor said, nothing wrong with your eyes. So finally his wife got him to go to his medical doctor. And within a day, they told Howard, you have brain cancer. Mm-hmm. And Howard, in a period of 6 months, had 5 surgeries on his brain. And, of course, you don't have surgery on your brain and not have some long-term negative effects as a result of that. And in talking to him, he said, you know, this has been difficult for me, but he said, I never in my life imagined that I would be a person with a disability, that I would need help. And it just kind of highlights that it happens in a flash, and it can happen to any of us. And so I believe that as we look at disability policies and systems and programs, that there is some wisdom in looking at those programs from the perspective of how would I like it to work and what would be helpful if it was me, if I had to use that program, if my child or my grandchild needed to use that program, what would my wish be? And I don't think we'd go overboard. I think we would have practical programs, compassionate programs, and programs that were set up to really allow people to move past disability and to get back to a life with a good standard of living. And my hope is that that's our goal. And finally, one other thing I want to say, I understand someone's going to be here to talk about spend downs mm-hmm. and medical assistance. I hope that they will talk about medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities. It is a very forward-thinking program. It is an excellent program, something the state of Minnesota can be incredibly proud of. It is one benefit program we can identify that allows people the opportunity to work up out of poverty and to move on. It encourages savings. It encourages retirement.
I was going to say, Ms. Smith, until you become 65 and then you're on the Medicare roller coaster. So.
Yes, and then we have more work to do. We have more work to do. But it's an ideal program, I think, worth a closer look. And the philosophy behind that program, I think, is a philosophy that I hope over time other benefit programs and systems will adapt. Because I think if we look at more people in our society having disabilities, we really need to do more to assist those folks to get on with their lives. I want to thank you for this opportunity to comment. I applaud your efforts at looking at this issue, and I would be happy to come back and answer some of those more complex questions about how benefits are impacted by working.
I think it would be helpful, too, Ms. Smith, for the committee, if you could put together a packet of some of those scenarios, and we would distribute them out to the committee members of some of these decisions that people make, obviously taking off confidential information. But, you know, really, when you're looking at dollars sometimes for a month, then
deciding whether or not you could go to work or you can't. And that assumes, of course, as you said earlier, that there was a family support network, perhaps with assets that purchased that car for you, and maybe you were able to qualify for a waiver program to modify the car for you, and then you were able to afford your insurance and other things. So thank you very, very much.
Sure, and I would be happy to provide those scenarios.
And Representative Anderson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Smith, work connection, you mentioned started in 1999. Are you strictly the Twin City, Hennepin County, or do you have satellite locations other places throughout, or are you national?
We serve the state of Minnesota statewide. Our primary office is in the Twin Cities. I do have three staff working in remote locations. We are available to people through a 1-800 hotline number, so we've tried to make it very easy for people anywhere in the state to get a hold of us, to immediately get to a live person who can begin to talk to them and answer their questions. I do have brochures from my agency that say a little bit more about that, and I'll be happy to leave those and provide those to you.
Are you national?
We are not national. We are a Minnesota program. However, every state in the country, as a result of the Ticket to Work and the Work Incentive Improvement Act of 1999, do have programs similar to ours. We got started a year earlier than the other states because we got a special statewide partnership initiative grant from Social Security, so our program has probably a year and a half head start on some of the other states in the country.
Yeah. Thank you. Your funding, where is that? Is it federal dollars?
At this point, our funding comes from the Social Security Administration. We get some funding through the Department of Human Services, the Pathways to Employment Project, and we have a fee-for-service contract with DEED. We have services branch, as well as some grant dollars from DEED. We have services branch. As we became nonprofit, we were also able to secure some substantial dollars from foundations who wanted to support the transition from state government to nonprofit, and we're looking in the future at how to further diversify our income so that it is not all government-oriented.
And if I could, thank you, Mitch. Has there been any work done on, I mean, it sounds like you have some kind of a tool that you use to walk people through on kind of making it more of a internet-based tool that some people could access? You know, it sounds like something maybe that could move in that direction.
Since the years that I've been working with people with disabilities who have been working, and that does go back 30-some years now, there has been conversations about that. Social Security spent millions of dollars on a program that they hoped would allow people to be able to tap in some numbers on a computer and get kind of a printout back telling people exactly how their benefits would change. After many years working on that program, the administration has scrapped it because it doesn't work. There are some new online programs coming on that are becoming available to states, and we are looking at that here in Minnesota. And I think that it is very hard to get into the computer all of the individualized circumstances, because you have the general rules for these programs, and then you have all these exceptions and little nuances that you have to know about to really get to accurate information. I think those tools on the website can prove to be training instruments or teaching instruments or estimators for people to get an idea. But I would want people to be really sure they've got the whole picture before they actually make a leap into giving up their benefits.
Two other, if I could, thanks. One is on the diminishment of benefits as people go to work. If the state were to step in and replace federal dollars, would that immediately count as another dollar that person is earning, and so they would decrease their federal benefits even that much farther? Does that question make sense?
It does make sense, and potentially it would count. Because SSI is a means-tested program, The same is any dollar counts as a dollar. And so you'll find that even people who get $100 at Christmas, if they report that as a gift at Christmas, if they report that to Social Security, they may see their benefit check 2 months later reducing as a result of having gotten that income.
Okay. And the last question I had, I've now lost, it looks here. So I don't, but thank, I thought this was really, really helpful. So thank you for coming in.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
And Representative Ward, do you have one question?
Just to follow up, thank you, Madam Chair, just to follow up, Ms. Smith, from Representative Anderson's question. Where are those three remote or satellite areas in the state?
Right now, I have people in Moorhead. I have a person in Moorhead, a person in Bemidji, and a person in Stacy. I used to have a person in Mankato. She moved to Stacy, so the satellite moved with her. We are in the process of hiring an additional staff person, and we are hoping to find a qualified person in the southern part of the state. The difference that makes to us is that if someone needs to see us face-to-face and needs an in-person visit, it's more convenient if we've got people already in those areas of the state. If you talk to people around the state, everybody wants a representative in their city. There just isn't enough dollars to do that. But through the 1-800 number, over 9 years' time, we have found that we can do an awful lot of business with folks around the state just over the phone. And many people have gotten used to doing that. And so that's an efficiency for us at this time.
Representative Norton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. As long as you're here, I know this is the, I guess it's cheating. I'm asking you to give me an answer that maybe you can't give me. But as long as you're here and you're an expert in the area, I feel like I need to ask. One of the questions that I wrote down while you were talking is there something that you've seen through your work that the legislature could do to help this, some of the gaps and transition that you talked about with the work? And you gave a couple suggestions, but then one of the answers I just heard was we can't fill in because people are penalized and we don't want to do that. And that the disabilities fluctuate comment that you made, and that people may need to come back and forth into the program.
Mm-hmm.
Having said all that, do you have a suggestion for a direction we might look with policy change that would be helpful?
It is difficult for me today without really sitting down and looking at all of the factors to give you some really specific prime ideas. But I would say that generally, I think that although if the state intervened for people on SSI in some way, in concert with the Social Security Administration, it's possible that we could work something out. Right now, the Social Security Administration seems very open to doing pilot projects with states, trying different ways to encourage people to go to work and to support people in working. So I don't want to shut that door completely, because I think there are potential options there. I also think in terms of our state benefit programs, there could be some value in laying those out and looking at how they operate and how the rules are consistent with each other or inconsistent, to see if there's something we can do to make that more streamlined, easier for people to understand and to manage. And I believe that if we put our heads together, the disability community could probably come up with a couple of good ideas for how to fill some of those gaps that do exist for people when they start to make that leap to employment.
And thank you very much for that. I hope I didn't put you on the spot, but I just, with your expertise here and all the experience you've had, I just felt it was helpful for us. So thank you very much.
And I will do some more thinking about that, and I will pick some other brains and send ideas forward to Representative Medora.
Thank you very much.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just driving in this morning, I noticed, and I'm just, this is kind of off the top of my head, but looking for ways to help the disabled community to keep more of their money and maybe get themselves out of a poverty, or what we would consider a poverty situation. Going past just a gas station, it said, looking for deer hides, we'll give you gloves in exchange. Meaning they'll take your deer hides and they'll make gloves and you get the gloves back. I'm wondering if in-kind contributions where someone who's got a skill or something that's been able to do if they were to volunteer themselves, and we were to put some kind of a, maybe not necessarily for say a real value on it, but something that would bring back intrinsic value to the individuals or the community, that there could be some kind of a way to utilize that in a formula. Just giving you an idea, a thought of how they could, I know we're always looking for volunteers at the food shelves and different places, especially at the holiday time and other times throughout the year, where someone of a disabled situation, I have a daughter who is disabled, who would love to be able to do something more than what she does working in functional industries. But if she does and tries to get paid for it, she loses on the paper.
I think there are probably other people here in the room that could comment more succinctly about that, but I would just say from my personal perspective, a lot of people with disabilities do start with volunteer work as a way to kind of test out their abilities and maybe as a way to fill in resumes. And so it could be a starting point for some people. Mm-hmm. My own personal bias is that at some point we need to really help people move to paid employment, that we need, that people are more part of the community, have more choices when they have more income, and we hear so much about the intrinsic value of getting a paid job that my focus would always be on that. But I know what you're talking about, and I know that there is some value for some people to begin that way. So perhaps other people here would want to comment about that as the day goes on.
Thank you very, very much. And as somebody who's gone through one of those paperwork nightmares, I think people also need to understand that they are allowed to go back up to 5 years in requesting paperwork reprints. So imagine having to fill out the first application and then getting a letter saying, oh, by the way, 3 years ago we miscalculated, and now you need to submit all the paperwork to justify where you're at. It is a nightmare, and for the worker that is now on the other side of that, I'm happy about that. I'm sad that she has that situation in front of her, but I think we should, anybody who says just go apply to one of these programs should actually have to apply and go through that process, because I don't think anybody can realize the amount of stress, the demands on that, and then the just the stockpile that you need to keep once you do that. I mean, it's incredible, you know. It's incredible. So I'm very appreciative that you were here today, and I think the scenarios would be an excellent addition for us to have for some people who want to go and using those thresholds.
And I will get those to you.
Yes, thank you very, very much. Okay,
Ms. Peck, why don't you come next, and then we'll, Brad, yeah, Cecil.
Good morning.
Could you identify yourself?
Yes, for the record, my name is Kimberly Peck. I'm the Director of Rehabilitation Services with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I'm actually thrilled to be able to follow Barb Smith. I know when the questions initially came up about SSI and SSD, and I saw Barb sitting up there, I thought, we've got to get her up to the table as quickly as possible. You know, DEED and Rehabilitation Services is one of those programs that helps provide the financial support for the Work Incentive Connection to do its work. And if I had the resources and the wherewithal, I would clone Barb and her staff 100 times over. But I don't have that opportunity, at least not yet. You know, I have prepared and provided to the committee written testimony. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through that and just invite you to look at that later. But what I'd like to do is just very briefly talk about who Rehabilitation Services is. As Barb talked about it, in terms of work, paid work as really the ticket for individuals with disabilities to get out of poverty, Rehabilitation Services is the program that provides the support for individuals to achieve their employment goals and objectives. It's a program that's funded largely by the federal government, 80% by the federal government, and that the balance of matching state funds, and thanks to the legislature this last session, you increased our state appropriations so we could pull down the full amount of federal dollars. So it's a program that provides services statewide. It's work that is nothing less than honorable, but also very, very challenging. And I want to speak to the question that was asked, what ideas, what suggestions, what recommendations do you have for us in terms of what the legislature could do to try to solve this problem? As I had a briefing with Representative Medor before the hearing started, you know, we're not going to solve it today, but we can inch forward. And I know that's frustrating for her to hear that because she'd like to take giant leaps. And I applaud that enthusiasm and that energy. You know, the public vocational rehabilitation program has all sorts of rules and regulations that we have to operate under. From my perspective, where I believe that the state legislature can be most helpful and make the biggest difference, in addition to some of the conversation around, you know, SSI and housing and transportation, because that's clearly huge. But from my perspective, the need for ongoing support for individuals with disabilities. Part of the material that was submitted to you were stories that one of our researchers in rehabilitation services did. I asked Steve Scholl to do a qualitative study on those individuals who are working with rehabilitation services but for any number of reasons choose to work a low number of hours and as a result continue to live in poverty. The stories are very compelling. I encourage you to take the time to read them. You'll find them captivating. But essentially what came out of those stories is what you've already heard today, that the challenges, the barriers, the obstacles for individuals with disabilities have to do with just managing the realities and the challenges of their disability itself. An additional challenge has to do with transportation. There's a reference in one of the stories about how an individual had to ride 3 hours on the bus in order to work 2 hours in a day. And so when you do the math, again, it's not feasible. The third piece of it was a piece that Barb touched on, and that is that fear of losing benefits and how that safety net might be jerked away from individuals as they begin to take the steps towards employment. The recommendation that I want to make to this committee is considering what more Minnesota could do by way of providing ongoing support. The Public Vocational Rehabilitation Program, funded again by the feds and in part by state, we're able to provide time-limited services and supports, which includes employment, training, all those supports that's necessary for individuals to find a job and to begin to get settled into that job. But after 90 days or thereabouts, we have to close the case because we've got lots of people knocking on our door. As Barb mentioned, as the studies will illustrate, many disabilities are remitting in nature, or you'll see kind of a recurrence of the symptoms of the challenges. What we must do is provide a mechanism and resources for those individuals to have the ongoing supports that they need to continue to maintain competitive employment. Right now, Minnesota has, through its extended employment program, and those are all state dollars, you know, are providing ongoing supports, and those stories that you'll see in the materials that I submitted to you are all participants in the extended employment program. Individuals with disabilities who are able to continue in competitive employment because they have these ongoing supports. But the extended employment program is at capacity. The only way that additional individuals can get into that program and have the resources to secure those ongoing supports is that someone leaves at the other end. And so we truly are maxed out. You know, what I will be doing within the next couple of weeks, and certainly one of my priorities in the strategic plan for rehabilitation services, is to identify and to work across agencies with DHS and DEED and the Department of Education in taking a look at what more needs to be done in terms of policy changes and resource allocation for ongoing support. So that's one piece. Another recommendation, and certainly is consistent with the direction that we are going in rehabilitation services, is to focus much more energy on transition age youth. You know, because we need to identify those young people when they're still in high school. And we need to provide them the support, the work experience, the opportunity to change their mindset about what their future can be. And if we invest the resources and time in reaching out to those transition age youth, providing them the support,
providing them the assistance with post-secondary education, they can graduate from college and get a really, really good job. So those are my two recommendations for this committee, is focusing on ongoing supports and the resources that the state can provide to support that, as well as encouraging Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and DEED to focus its energy on transition age youth. So with that, I will open it up to any questions that the committee might have.
Do we have any questions? This is Representative Ward.
Thank you. Just a comment on your comprehensive plan with Department of Ed, DEED, and DHS. As I was graduating from high school many years ago, Department of Voc Rehab became involved in my life because of my handicap, and it gave me opportunities to better myself, and I grabbed onto those and used them, and so I'm really encouraging you to again do that, and then some of the programs went away, but it made a huge impact in my life, and obviously I turned out okay. Some people disagree with that, but I'm really strongly encouraging you to try to do that again for the disabled community with Department of Ed and DEED and DHS to make the differences, because it does work. It does produce folks that are contributing members to our society, especially in the disabled community. So please go get it.
We are asking, that is a number one priority, not only on the state level, but on the federal level. Just last week, we had our federal funder from Rehabilitation Services Administration come out and unveil the federal strategic performance plan. And it is very clear in RSA's performance plan that their expectation of all states is that they will put significant amount of energy into serving transition age youth. You know, all of the other strategic goals in their plan reference services to individuals with the most significant disabilities. However, in that goal specific to transition age youth, the federal government is setting that qualifier aside and is saying you must work with all transition age youth with disabilities. And the rationale for that makes perfect sense in my mind, because we need to invest at this perfect opportunity, because these investments at this point in time will make a lifetime of difference for those individuals. So again, it will be left to the state to figure out how we pull that off, but you certainly have my commitment that that is a chief priority for us.
Mm-hmm. Representative Martin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate you getting very specific about two recommendations, and if I can just ask you to give, and it's perhaps my naivety, but give me a little more direction as to what the ongoing supports are. You talked about the 90-day limit, which seems mm-hmm. very short for mm-hmm. someone that's transitioning, and I can right. understand that. So is it, is that a legislative 90 days, something that we can change? Is it just because you don't have enough staff, so that's what you're needing? I guess I'm looking for what specifically.
Okay. Thank you for your question. The 90-day is actually a requirement from our federal legislation that says, you know, there aren't nearly enough resources to go around. So we need to focus what resources we have on assisting individuals in getting a start. And then the federal government, I believe very deliberately, is looking to the states to step up, to say, we'll get it started in a substantive way, but it's up to the states to continue to do the good work. And again, Minnesota has the extended employment program, all state dollars. We have about $12 or $13 million currently in the extended employment program. But again, we're at capacity with that, and we need additional dollars, both in the extended employment side, the DT&H side, which is DHS, and so on. So I hope that answered your question. Okay.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just mentioned you're at capacity with the extended employment program. In looking at your statistics and all the different things, and you said $12 or $13 million that you have, do we need to double that?
Is this like, am I making my Christmas list? You know, that's an excellent question. And part of the policy work that we'll be beginning in earnest in January is in conversations with DHS and my staff is to say, okay, if we are going to make a substantive impact, what's it going to take? Because that's the kind of information that you need. You know, I would love to ask for the stars, but frankly, none of us can make that happen. So we'll be very thoughtful about our evaluation of the missing pieces, the gaps, and providing you some numbers.
Madam Chair, Ms. Peck, the $12-13 million, is this with BHS and education, or is it strictly for your?
Yeah, the extended employment program is strictly with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, Rehabilitation Services. The Department of Human Services has the day training and habilitation programs, which are funded by Medicaid dollars and many of the waiver programs. And the reason that I believe it's so important for us to have the conversation in concert with DHS is that we have to look at the whole picture. And as a community, as a public entity, we have to say what makes sense for us in terms of the investment of the limited dollars. I really believe strongly that competitive work is an option, is a viable option for far more people than what are currently being given the opportunity. So I think we have to take a look at how we're currently spending Medicaid dollars on sheltered work settings and challenge the system to move it up, to provide competitive employment opportunities. And I suspect that the business climate will be ready and eager for that, because in just a matter of a very few years, they're going to be screaming for talented labor.
Okay. Another follow-up, respect. Competitive employment, I take it you're using private employment or businesses out there to employ, as well as state agencies and other government agencies locally or whatever the situation is?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the significant transformations, and I think that's an apt word to use, that BEAD has done recently is to develop a business services unit whose charge really is to develop relationships with business, to understand what their needs are, not only current but future needs, and then take that information, bring it back to us, those individuals that are working with a job seeker, to help them develop their career path, such that when we are funding post-secondary education, the outcome of that is there's a job waiting for that individual when they're done. So we're working very, very hard to develop relationships with business. And frankly, you know, the approach that we are taking with business is not simply it's the nice thing to do, it's the right thing to do, but it's good business sense. They need workers, they need reliable workers, they need skilled workers, and here's an untapped pool to provide that to them.
Madam Chair, what I wanted to get to is the real question is, what are the obstacles you find when you go out to the job sites or go out to the businesses and be able to, for them to take on a person that has a disability? Because I know that with my daughter trying to find a job, there are circumstances that don't allow her, although she could, yet the circumstances are such that if there was some way to get through this, I don't know, obstacle course or whatever they have, the businesses haven't, and be able to utilize an individual with that disability. And I'm just wondering what your experience is as far as
Our experience within rehabilitation services is probably one of the largest obstacles or barriers is ignorance and lack of information and a lack of awareness. So that is why one of the critical parts of the business services activity is to educate employers about the reality. Another piece is to be able, frankly, to offer those ongoing supports to employees, particularly for those individuals who have disabilities that will recur in nature. For us to be able to say, yes, this likely will happen, but don't worry about that because there are resources that will step in and assist you. The other vision that I have, and it's a few years off, is to raise the bar for employers to understand that if they want to be effective as a business, that their employee pool has to represent the full spectrum of humanity. And so they need to incorporate the level of natural support that every employee needs. So at this point in time, I'm asking the legislature to consider increasing the funds to provide those ongoing supports. But wouldn't it be glorious 10 years from now to have the employer say, this is just part of what we do. This is a cost of doing business, and we'll provide that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you this morning.
Thank you very, very much. Next we have Red One. Please come on up.
Thank you.
Oh, no, he's got a bag. There we are. Yeah, yeah. And welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the tape, and then go ahead and...
I will represent Medora in the committee. My name is Brad Trahan from Rochester, Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to talk to you guys today. I want you guys to know that when I talk about our situation on parental fees, I'm talking about one family. We have families across the state of Minnesota that it doesn't matter what the special need is. Autism is no less or no more important than anything else out there. I'm coming to you today as a father of three, and I'm also coming to you today as a founder of the RT Autism Awareness Foundation that my wife and I founded in May of 2003. If you look at these photos, one of those kids up there has a special need. It may not be evident, but one of them does. January 23rd was a tough day for my wife and I. It was at that time that we learned that our son Reese, right there in the middle, was diagnosed with severe autism. At the time, we realized that a lot of questions go, what do you do, where do you turn to? There's a lot of unknowns out there. I used to officiate high school basketball in the state of Minnesota for 17 years. I had the honor to work 10 state tournaments, supervisor officials for two of them. I worked over 600 ball games. If you take all 17 of those years and all those games, nothing has been more difficult than dealing with the day-to-day issues of having a child with autism. I come today talking about parental fees. But let me assure you, as I come and asking for the state's help on parental fees because the current system is flawed, I'm also putting full court press on the private insurance industry because they, by failing to cover our kids with autism therapy, they're pushing this problem down onto the state, thus it has to get pushed down to you as lawmakers, and it goes down to schools, it's a spill-down effect. So I assure you, through a local congressman, the full court press is on. I used to work for the Mayo Clinic. My wife still does as a cardiac surgical nurse. We learned that he needed 20 to 30 hours of intense ABA therapy, applied behavioral analysis, which is one of the best-known therapies out there today. There's many, but that's best-known. It was going to cost $100,000 a year. At the time, the only facility that offered such a service like that was, to our knowledge, was Partners in Excellence in Burnsville, Minnesota. We were willing to make that trip every day or whatever needed to give Reese the best quality of life possible. It was supported by a second male physician. However, when it came time for the insurance side of Mayo Clinic to ask for help, we were denied. What you see here is a pile that I won't ask Jen to copy for you guys. I'll leave it right here. But that was our vigorous appeal. We lost appeal one. We lost appeal two. But guess what? We won appeal three. The Blue Cross Blue Shield currently has a great plan in place. It was only because former Attorney General, Sue Blue Cross Blue Shield, now they got a good plan in place. I asked for that Mayo Clinic to follow suit. If you're going to make patient care, education, research a priority, you must provide therapy for our kids. The argument that I upheld is that I was told that ABA therapy was educational and or investigational in need. Through a three-party psychiatric review of our son's file, I proved them wrong. That three-party psychiatric review said it's not educational or investigational. It needs to be treated, and it's known out there. But where it got political was since Reese's therapy won't come from a psychologist or a psychiatrist, we were denied. So we won, but we were denied. We got great facilities in this town that have programs overseen by psychologists or psychiatrists. But they may not have an MD or PhD behind their name, but they are making huge progress with our kids out there. Rochester Center for Autism has kids employed with college degrees and 3,000 hours of business-related experience. They're making progress. If you don't have a college degree, there's 6,000 hours of related experience doing wonders. And by paying them, not a psychologist or psychiatrist, even though the program's overseen by it, you're saving up to a third. It's costing taxpayers in this nation $90 billion a year to take care of our individuals with autism. we can reduce that by up to 60% with early intervention. Our son was diagnosed at 33 months, and he is at the most severe end, plus moderate mental retardation. However, we can get to these kids at 18 to 20 months. Time is of essence. So we had to call on the state of Minnesota and put us on a medical assistance, a program that is only based on parental income. I resigned from the clinic because I refused to work for an organization that's going to stand behind the shields that they support. And I take that position today. My fight with the private insurance industry stays vigorous. At the same token, our initial fee was over $800 a month. $800 a month. We never thought we were going to be in this position. When my wife and I said I do on May 3rd, we never thought we'd be in this position. We had good jobs. The diagnosis is an emotional one. You don't get to take family trips together. You don't get to go to church together. Restaurants are far and few between. It tears families apart. 70% of our moms and dads out there that have children with autism and their marriage and divorce. At a time that our kids need our parents most, they're splitting up. Parental fees are a factor. They're a big factor. What we had to do initially to keep Reese on that program was we put some of the payments on credit cards. I stand here today in front of you. My job is I'm a collector for an attorney. I'm probably the nicest collector out there because I understand. We're not filing bankruptcy. We're fighting through it. But you know what? It is not easy. Since then, fees have gone down from $500 to $600, and just recently, the state of Minnesota won't have to worry about the Tran family and Reese Tran anymore because we got notification that our fee now is going to be $704.29 a month. My wife and I had to make the decision, how longer can we go on with this? Do we keep putting ourselves in debt, or do we stop it and just hope for the best and put it in the big man's hands upstairs? As of last month in September, we stopped Reese's therapy at the Rochester Center for Autism. And this Friday, I'm meeting with our financial advisor to cash in early retirement I have, and I'll take the tax penalties, and I'll be paying off the state $11,200. I can walk away with pride knowing that we did our best. However, why are we putting families in this position? I propose to you to look at this in the future, to base parental incomes on a 40-hour work week for a single family or an 80-hour work week for a double family income. Let moms and dads out there that if they're going to work second jobs and extra shifts as we did and many others do, take that extra money and save it for their own retirement. Because you know what? My family and many others, we're not. Let us give us an opportunity to save for the college fund of our future siblings. Because our family and many others are not. It's a problem that families shouldn't have to be faced with. I sent to Jen and look forward to you. I think we need to learn earlier, Representative Norton asked the prior speaker what kind of solutions that maybe you can bring to the table. One of the solutions, I don't know if it's a solution, but it's something I want you to look at, is what the state of Wisconsin did via their task force in 2004 in Governor Doyle. There's a parental fee scale on there that they used. I called Wisconsin, spent time on the phone with those folks, and I learned that my fee of $705 in the state of Minnesota would have costed me $401 in the state of Wisconsin. So I would encourage this committee to please take a look at their structure. I would ask this committee to please take a look at what Wisconsin did in creating the Wisconsin Autism Task Force, where that governor went out there and he met with the families. He saw the need. And from May of 04 to September of 04, that task force came back with 38 recommendations. We have nothing to lose as a state. We owe it to our children, we owe it to our families, and yes, we owe it to the taxpayers of this, not only state, but this country. We have programs, and we also must keep up the heat on the private insurance industry. We have programs to treat those people for chemical dependency, for drugs and alcohol, which I fully support. However, those people have a choice to enter into that. Reese never had that choice. His peers never had that choice. But we're going to deny them a neurological brain disorder. This problem has been pushed down to the state because our private insurance industry has failed. 80% of our families out there that are on medical assistance also pay private health insurance. We are being double whammied. We are being penalized because we have a child with special needs. Mm-hmm. I've also called on the governor to create the Minnesota Autism Task Force, and maybe that task force is this committee right here. I've worked on that through Congressman Walz, which the letter is now public. He's sent letters back about this and that, but he's never addressed parental fees. We need to fully address parental fees. It's driving families apart. It's putting families into bankruptcy, and it's darn hard. It's hard to deal with it. I dread the month of September. I love Thanksgiving because you're with family. You're with your loved ones. You don't have to stress. And we come into a month where it's all materialistic. Joy and I will rearrange our bill structure so we can make sure that we put toys under that tree. Someday, Joy and I won't be on this earth. The responsibility of Reese will come amongst Brendan and Peyton, two children who have had to grow up way too fast for the years. I hear from a family member that has had to go off medical assistance for the fact that a male doctor has diagnosed it and said, get on medical assistance because our program will cover it. That's what's going on out there, folks. Embarrassing. Unethical. Unjust. I'm on 18 speaking engagements between the month of November and December talking about autism. And I was at a speaking engagement 2 weeks ago where a mom admitted she's hiding money from the state because this will count against her. Why are we forcing parents to hide money? And she says the biggest thing that bothers her is that she knows she's doing it, she knows it's wrong, but it is her last straw of hope. That's the position we're putting into. It's not fun. Not easy. So I come to you today to simply ask you to take what I afford you from the state of Wisconsin. I certainly encourage you to, with any private insurance connections that you have, to make sure that they understand the full court press will be on. You know, I had a Senate Health and Hearing Committee that was down in Rochester that Representative Norton was at. A doctor from the Mayo Clinic made a comment about a person in Duluth with regards to health care and trying to change the system. He said, they're happy because now they're dealing with a man that instead of leading a life of disability, he's now leading a life of productivity. Folks, that's all we want for our kids. We didn't know Reese when he was born had autism. We know he's saying dad and mama 11 months. We know he looked at the camera. We know he did everything. I'm not going to sit and tell you what my position is on the cause because, you know, frankly, none of us know. We must all stay open-minded. But I will tell you this. We need to keep the full court press on. I'm calling on you as well to pressure this governor to create this task force. And because if the state of Wisconsin can find 38 recommendations in 5 months, I'm confident in your ability that you're going to look at a system and you're going to make positive, productive change. The state of Colorado, I believe it's Colorado, they've created the Colorado Autism Treatment Fund. What they're doing is they're assessing a $10 service charge on speeding tickets and a $15 service charge on DUIs. Is that the solution? Maybe not. But I want to be part of the solution. I don't want to come here and just ask you for anything. And when I close with this, is that when we come here, we know that sometimes, and obviously in this case, tax dollars got to be used. Through our foundation in Olmsted County, our foundation has initiated the Project Lifesaver campaign, where we take a transmitter similar to your watch, Representative, and we equip children not only with autism, but Down syndrome and anything else, anybody that can wander. And we can track these individuals if they run away from home. No tax dollars. We raised the $15,000 to get it going. We will have 9 counties around Olmsted County implemented, up and running by October of 2008. So when I come to you today asking for help on the tax side, know that we are working hard on the private side to make ends meet. We feel it's got to be a team effort. No longer again do I want to be in a search in Wisconsin and see police officers cry and people hug one another when they report that Benji Hyle was found dead in a pond 200 yards south of his home. Autism. And just 3 days later in Blaine, we lost Carly Dickerson. It's not right. It's not fair. Never again do I want to see a father kiss a casket to say goodbye to his son. Never again do I want to see a mother stand at her son's casket and know she'll never hold her son in his arms ever again, even though Benji's in a better place. The day-to-day struggles are stressful. This takes time. It takes effort. Now I'm asking you for whatever help you can give us. And I know you're going to go at it, but we need to have change, and we need to start now because time is of essence. Any questions?
Do they have questions? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad, you mentioned Wisconsin. What did, and there was, 35 solutions or 35 different things that they came up with. how did they go about, I mean, you make a comparison of $705 in Minnesota to $400 a month in Wisconsin. What did Wisconsin do to come up with the wherewithal to, you mentioned Colorado having different types of fees and stuff that they had on. Is there specific things that Wisconsin did that we can take an example look at?
Well, one thing that I appreciate, Chair, and then Representative's question, and I think that's what we need to begin studying with our neighbors to the east, to make the contact and see what they did. I provided you a sheet with the front and back with their scale and the percentages, where it talks about the income, it talks about where a family would come into. They have a formula that they have created. And that's one of the changes that they brought back from what Governor Doyle had asked for in the spring of 2004. So I think that's something that we really need to study long and hard to say, what did our neighbors to the east do to make this a little bit easier to the families? It's okay to learn. Wisconsin is actually one of the best states to work with our kids. So I think it's a detailed formula. However, I think a blueprint right here has been laid out. I think it needs to be looked into. I think it needs to be investigated because maybe we can learn from this. I didn't enclose a 31-page report of the final findings. That was sent to you via electronically from Jen just because I was going to give you 31 pages.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad's from my hometown, doesn't live in my district, but I hear from him regularly nonetheless. And I just, you know, he's been such an advocate for families of children with autism and for the children themselves. Don't always agree with his tactics, but I cannot ever say anything but positive things for his passion and the work he's done. One of the things that came up in the Rochester hearing was this issue with TEFRA, and I'm quite convinced it was put into place for all the right reasons. I'm becoming less convinced that it's maybe the right thing to do anymore, and I think Brad raised some issues here with regard to the insurance companies, and it isn't right that we have families paying double payments for insurance coverage or a parental fee for additional services. If this is important and necessary for our children, then we need to find a way to make it covered under the 80% that already have insurance under those policies, and have TEFRA and MAB for the 20% who don't have insurance coverage, not a duplicate. And so I guess I would just challenge this committee as we move forward to really look into the need for TEFRA. What can families get from TEFRA that they're not able to get from their insurance company, and how can we bridge that gap and do it, you know, as Brad has done, which is go at it from a little different angle rather than making it a state responsibility, knowing that ultimately we all pay for health care, you know, anyway. But I do feel badly for Brad and the other families that have to make the decision to give up their parental fees, which means giving up services for their children. And my hope is that when you're not having to pay parental fees, and I understand you have the back pay that you're working on, and good for you for your commitment to do that, is that that money that was going to parental fees can still go to have Reese get some services, the ABA therapy that he was getting, and others. So good luck with that, and we will work at our end, and I know you'll continue to work at your end.
Thanks, Representative Norton. Chair, you know, you're right. I appreciate all the support you've given, and especially not being, you know, in my district and whatnot. I'd probably do some things out there and say some things that maybe not be politically correct, but there's nothing I've done in 4 years that hasn't been factual. And sometimes you got to take that position, because we've had to make our family history very public. And I hear from a lot of families, and guess what? Even though it made me, even though I'm not, probably not the most popular person with the Mayo Clinic right now, I got a lot of families got my back right now, because I hear from them, and we're going to stand up, because we're done hiding our children with autism. We are. When we look in society, what we want, if you're going to apply for that new job, if you're going to trial for that sports team, if you're going to run for office, what's the one thing we all want in common? We want a chance. I come before you today just to say, please help us give all of our disability committee, which I don't like the word disability. We have different abilities. I hate the word disability. We're labeling people, and we should not be. We all have special talents. We have special needs. We have different abilities. But that's all we want is a chance. And finally, I close with this. I personally ask that you support House File 2426. It's something that Representative Norton has signed on to, Senator Sendum. And as we learned on October 16th at a House and Health and Human Services Committee, the average length of time to get your child in for a medical diagnosis or a renewal is anywhere from 7 to 12 months. What this House file does, as I approach this with Representative Norton and Senator Sendum, is we ask that now the state gives the county 6 months notification instead of the 3 months notification it currently is. What's happening is we're getting families getting 3 months notification that their eligibility is going to run out. The problem is, my friends, is we can't get our kids in the doctor's office quick enough. We respect the procedure. We respect what the state has to do. However, we're not being allowed enough time to do it. Thus, we have parents losing out. We have parents stressing out. House file 2426 would extend that notification from 3 months to 6 months. No dollars spent, just a simple allotted time, an extra 3 months to help our families out.
Brad, I'm sorry, did you? Oh, okay. It would be great if we could get a copy of that, though. It would be super. Since we're talking about poverty here, though, one of the things that I wanted for you to touch on is, you know, like you, I'm in the same boat, and our plummet into poverty was very fast once the diagnosis happened because of the need for services right away. And, of course, the federal government did us no favor by changing the requirements for filing bankruptcy to no longer include medical expenditures. So for many of our families that are putting these medical procedures on their credit cards, they're looking at going from net worths of, you know, whatever the average may be, to plummeting down to basically once you refi your house, which I would love to get some statistics on how many of these foreclosures were parents refinancing, trying to get coverage for insurance programs, and then the double dipping of the insurance, and then the fact that you have that 7% threshold on the federal side before you can get reimbursed. I'm just wondering, do you have any statistics from the parents that you work with that talk about that? I mean, net worth that at one point may be, you know, a couple $100,000 if you own a home and you have some assets for retirement, to where you are once you get through this process.
You know, I can get that for you. I have over 80 families in our support group network that I contact that I'm sure would share what they can with us. I do know this. I remember going before I had a meeting with Senator Coleman back in 2004. A mom called me, she said, Brad, will you do me a favor? I said, what's that? She goes, let Senator Coleman know that we took a $60,000 second mortgage on our house for 6 months worth of therapy for our son. We don't know what we're going to do after that.
Right.
And that stuff is happening. It's happening rapidly. They are putting on credit cards. They're doing whatever they can to make ends meet. You know, they're not thinking about the mortgage payments, the cost of living, the gas prices. All this adds up, but that's not being a factor as far as the parental fee. And there's statistics out there. It hit us fast. It hits really fast. And you know what? We live day to day.
And that's what we end up doing, and I think that that's the saddest part, because these are all middle-income families. These are not, we didn't, you know, when our children are born, they don't look any different. There's no test, there's no blood test that says in 3 years you're living your life, you're going about this, and then you end up with this disability put in your lap, and then you are managing a disability, which is a totally different perspective for a lot of people. And I think that the way that we're attacking middle-income families, you know, if you're very poor, your parental fee is zero. You know, it doesn't change the fact that the child is eligible for services. The fact is, if you make more than a couple of dollars over a threshold, all of the services, the fact is, if you make more than a couple of dollars over a threshold, all of a sudden your parental fees are at such exorbitant levels. I mean, many of the families I worked with, our insurance fees were anywhere from $500 to $800 a month. We were on the high end of that, and the average was $200 a month parental fee. So when you start talking about fees like that every month, and that's to access services plus all of the paperwork, plus even when we have MA coverage, we're still dueling out with our private pay, it's very stressful, and it really can drain a family's ability to save for their future. So, and now, of course, they're tapping in and saying some of our retirement plans are questionable on whether or not they should be considered asset-based. So we've got a lot of problems to work on with this issue, and I appreciate you coming and talking to me about it and talking to the committee.
Thanks for everybody's time.
All right. Thank you. Okay. We are, as we always do every month, we run late. Mm-hmm. And we are here till noon. So what I'd like to do is we did want to touch on spend down quickly. So would we be able to do that? Do you think you can do that in about 15 minutes? Would that be fine? Because I and then Mr. Larson, we can have you after that. That's
only a few minutes.
Okay. And then Jennifer is Meredith is here. Okay. All right. So this is. And Cindy, if you can introduce yourself and your guest for the record, and then, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for the opportunity to address you. My name is Cindy Goodall. I'm a program director at Courage Center. And here with me today is Mary Richards, who is a client of Courage Center programs. And we're here to talk to you about the issues around spend downs for medical assistance, and specifically how that affects people with disabilities who earn Social Security disability income. So these are people who have paid, who have worked previously in their life and have paid into the Social Security system, then have become disabled, and then so their Social Security income is higher than what Barb was talking about with the SSI limits. And to qualify for medical assistance, there's two eligibility requirements. One is that you have to spend down your assets to below $3,000. And that asset limit hasn't changed since the late 80s. And certainly inflation has gone up quite a bit, but that $3,000 threshold has remained the same.
And can you explain what that $3,000 in assets is?
That's pretty much any asset other than the house that you live in.
So any cash, available
cash. Any retirement account, any contract for deed, any certificate of deposit, stocks, bonds, anything that you happen to own. You can only have $3,000. If not, you're no longer eligible for medical assistance.
So I just want that to sink in for a minute.
That's not a lot of money to have.
$3,000, that's it. That's it. And what's the value of a car that you can have?
You can have a car worth $4,000, and any value above the $4,000 is counted towards your $3,000, unless you can prove that you need it because of your disability. There are a few exceptions in there,
very
but not
few.
Very many. You know, if you own a cabin or a boat or anything else, all gets counted towards your assets.
Okay.
So that's one issue that, you know, basically you have to completely impoverish yourself, you know, get rid of all of your savings, all of your own safety net that you had earned and had saved up, has to be gone before you can receive your medical assistance. Then the other eligibility requirement is about your income eligibility, and that's based on the federal poverty guideline, which is, I'm kind of filling in, so I don't have my numbers exactly, but the federal poverty guideline is around $850 a month currently. And so if you make up to $850 a month on your Social Security, you receive your medical assistance without any kind of a spend down. So if you make $851, you have no spend down whatsoever. If you make over the $850 a month, then you have a spend down. So if you make $900 a month, you have to spend down your assets to 75% of the federal poverty guideline, which is about $640-something. So they don't just make you spend it down to the federal poverty guideline, which we already decided was you're poor enough, you know, but you have to go below that and get really, really poor to get on medical assistance. And so then, if you work, you know, as several jobs, you can make up to $1,500 a month on Social Security disability, but in effect, if you need medical assistance to pay for services that only medical assistance provides, you have to spend down to that level and live below the poverty level. And there are many, many services that only medical assistance provides. Medicare doesn't provide them. Social Security doesn't provide them. Most of those are in the long-term care realm or the mental health areas, PCA services, those kinds of things only medical systems will pay for.
And then, Cindy, could you also just explain again? I'm sorry you don't have your charts in front of you, but from memory, you know, what does qualify for the spend-down? In other words, you can't buy an extra bag of groceries and have that be a spend-down.
The monthly spend-down a month, which is kind of confusing because there's two different kinds of spend-downs, but the monthly spend-down amount that you have, basically you have to pay for the first, you know, $300 a month of your medical bills, and then medical assistance will kick in. So every single month you receive bills from your providers or from the state of Minnesota for $300, $400, $500 per month that you have to pay before your services would be paid for by medical assistance. So you can't, use that money to, and they don't take into account when they're looking at your income, you know, how much your housing costs are, how much your other, costs are related to your family or your children. If you are a parent with a disability and are on a waiver, they'll count you as a household of one, and you still have that same spend down. They don't give you any credit for having more people in your household. You just get $640-something. That's all you get on medical assistance. Now, the one way to get around that, that we do encourage people, and which is a good thing, is that you can work and go on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, or MAEPD, and then your premium for medical assistance is a sliding fee scale based on your income. And it's much, much more reasonable. So somebody with $1,000 income would pay like $40 a month for the medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities.
And are you required?
But not everybody can work.
I was going to say, and if you have a private pay option, are you required to try to work on the private pay option? Or can you exempt yourself from the private pay employer group plan and do the MA for EPD?
If you, usually they want you to have, you know, if you're eligible for insurance from other places like your employer, your spouse's employer, or something like that, you are supposed to use that first. Mm-hmm. And you also have to be on Medicare. Those costs towards those other insurance plans do count towards your spend down. So, you know, if you're paying $100 for your Medicare Part D premium and your Medicare premiums, that gets counted. But it's, you know, it's still you're just left with a $640 something.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Ms. Goodall, does it change when a person, say, becomes disabled after they're retired, say 65 and above? Or 60 and above, or whatever, you know, which makes no difference.
No, it's actually worse. After you turn 65, you can no longer go on medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities, so you don't even have the work option to get out of the spend down. I think if you're on EW, there's some, you have a waiver obligation that might be a little bit more affordable than the spend down issue, but I don't know those numbers for sure. But as soon as you hit 65, you no longer even get that opt out. Through work. And the part that's ironic to me and to the people that I work with who are trying to help clients around this issue and to help them understand that is that, you know, somebody who makes, you know, $847 a month, they get to keep all their money. Somebody who makes $870 has to spend down to $640. So, to me, it would make more sense to at least have the spend down guideline be the federal poverty guideline rather than 75%, but that would be my suggestion.
Yes.
Solely mine.
And we'll try that again this year.
Okay. That would be wonderful.
We tried it last year, and we'll try it again.
And Mary here has a personal experience with having a spend down and would like to talk about that, if that's okay.
Thank you for the opportunity to come to this forum and speak with you today. I feel honored to be here. My name is Mary Richards, and I have lived with a lifelong disability since birth that challenges me every day. I have been able to overcome my disability successfully, graduating from high school, receiving my associate's degree from college, and completing my education and receiving certification as an LPN. I am currently receiving services from Courage Center to assist me in coping with my disability, and those services include job placement, and I'm also in the ARMS program, and that stands for Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services.
Mm-hmm.
And that program is specifically covered by medical assistance. Other insurances do not cover that program. And that is a program for people dealing with mental health issues. My goal is to become employed again and become eligible for MAEPD so that my premium goes down considerably. As of right now, I have to pay $349 a month out of my $989, and makes things pretty tricky to get by. I've been working I've been able to work in a variety of work settings until April 2006. And as I said, the biggest challenge has been my spend down. And it just makes it difficult to survive in the community. And I, like anyone else in our great state of Minnesota, desire to be independent. And when I was working, I was paying the taxes and paying my way for things. And I'm just simply asking that the legislature or your committee take another look at this issue so that it doesn't continue to be an undue hardship. And I thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mary. Any other questions?
Any questions?
Hmm? All right. Well, then, thank you both very much. It would be helpful, too, for example, what we've asked from Barb Smith, if perhaps you could put together some worksheets for us of what this looks like.
Oh, okay.
Again, removing confidential information, but maybe some clients that you've been working with and how the spend down has affected them, perhaps when they come into the program, and then what those things look like.
For both spending down their assets and spending down monthly for their income eligibility then?
Yes, I think that would be helpful for everybody to have an idea for that.
Okay.
That would be great. And just very specific about what some of these things are.
Yeah.
You know, the car thing is a very difficult. A $4,000 vehicle in today's market is basically something that you wouldn't trust most people to be driving around in. So the idea that that's what we're kind of at, and those numbers have not changed in years. So
decades, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that would be great. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
And there are copies of my statement available.
Steve, I'm sorry. You know, we've got a person here, Jennifer Murtis, who has had a signer, and I guess she's been signing since 9 a.m. I didn't realize. I'm so sorry. I didn't realize that you had only one person. I'm so sorry. If Jennifer could come up, because I have a feeling that poor woman is about ready to. And I do apologize. I didn't. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I wanted
to wrap up. There you go. Hello, Madam Chair and community members. I am Jennifer Mears, a representative for those who are poor and disabled, especially the deaf and hard of hearing tenants in subsidized housing. I am deaf with a very low income and have been a victim of discrimination in subsidized housing apartment during 3 years. I continue to encounter discrimination every day. Poor and disabled are often
synonymous.
Many rental units do not have even the simplest accommodation for this type of tenant. Even the federally funded Section 8 apartment buildings housing the low-income elderly and disabled fails the needs of the low-income tenants. In addition, management companies often try to impose fees on the disabled for accommodations that should commonly be provided, particularly in federally funded subsidized projects, to comply with federal guidelines for accommodating people with disabilities. The Section 8 apartment should provide accommodations, such as visible components for safety features without charging fees. For example, adding a visual element such as a flashing light to those devices is inexpensive. And a number of vendors supply those type of systems. But even though I and other deaf tenants request these basic accommodations, the management companies of apartments where I have lived refuse to accommodate us, even after multiple requests. This also goes for others who have different types of disabilities, where management continues to ignore the request. Instead of installing visible doorbell, department staff will enter my apartment and the apartment of other deaf residents and proceed to flick the lights on and off. Many of these intrusions were unannounced and unscheduled. None of these entries were for emergency situations. My privacy was violated numerous times. This was the standard operating procedure for the management company in its treatment of deaf tenants living in subsidized housing. We are talking about tenants with incomes of $7,000 to $8,000 a year or less. Because tenants who have low incomes are often disabled, often fear of losing the housing. They seldom, if ever, challenge management. Violation, too many to mention today, continues for weeks, for months, for years. Example. Management company refused to install fire alarms and smoke detectors that are visible components such as a flashing light. The hearing residents have their needs met, but for the deaf residents, requests for even the most basic safety needs are ignored. Some might say, why not just move out of the place? Well, the waiting list for subsidized housing are long. A housing voucher can take years and years to get. And the list for housing in an area where a single deaf woman would feel safe are even longer. Plus, why should a deaf tenant be forced to move from their homes when it would be easy for the management company to make a few simple accommodations? Accommodations that they should have been making because they were receiving federal funds. These types of discriminations have been going on for at least the past 25 years for deaf and low-income tenants at various rental housing throughout the Twin Cities area and elsewhere. I have known and noticed that this occurs more often in subsidized low-income housing. In conclusion, to ignore the needs of tenants who are poor and disabled is discrimination. And the failure to provide the basic needs of the poverty, low-income tenant is invisible violence. The landlords and management companies of Section 8 and non-Section 8 housing should treat all of its tenants with respect and offer all tenants equal access to the kind of housing they need and deserve. I hope we can make things better in terms of housing and adequate services for the deaf and disabled tenants who are poor, and ensure that everyone has equal access to housing. I encourage you to take into consideration the needs and the best interests of those who are poor and disabled tenants, and I hope that my testimony has given you some valuable information about a segment of the population with which you may have had limited contact. Thank you for all your valuable time.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Mertes, I'd just like to know if your tenant or the person that you're renting from, have they made your living conditions better?
They have made it difficult, and it's been a living nightmare for me. And some of the accommodations I requested are still not being met, so it's still a constant battle.
I'm sure the follow-up question is, are your privacy rights still being violated?
It happened once at some place. I couldn't say that I'm in that now. So it's something that needs to be stopped. And people think they will realize, you know, in their own home, people don't just come in, you know, to a deaf tenant. We want to be treated equally, you know. I mean, the people with houses, they have doorbells, and doorknockers, it's the same purpose the reason for that. So it's like, why can't they provide doorbells to make it easier instead of just coming in unannounced?
Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there a an advocacy organization for you to call when you've asked or any tenant asked the Section 8 Housing Authority, the management, for an accommodation and it doesn't happen? Are you expected to handle that yourself, or is there someone, a number that you can call or an advocacy organization that will handle that for you that you're aware of?
Well, the not a program specifically designed for deaf and hunting tents. So there's very limited resources and help in that area. So I just have like a program to help so a tenant can go through to get some help. But it's very limited, it's very hard. And I've been dealing with this for 17 years. I'm tired mentally, emotionally, and physically. It keeps going on and on and needs to be stopped.
Well, thank you very much for coming in this month. And thanks to your interpreter.
Now, I'm just wondering, is there a Manly Sino?
Madam Chair, ironically, Manly had to go meet with his financial worker.
Oh, no!
At Hennepin County. So, he actually will be trying to make our meeting with you this afternoon.
Okay.
And share what he was going to share, which will reinforce a lot of what we've already heard this morning in regards to difficulties that individuals with disabilities have with poverty. I'm Steve Larson, the Executive Director of the ARCA Minnesota, and I'm also just recently been elected co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. John Cheetah had been in that position for 6 years, and I have big shoes to fill as far as that goes. A couple of comments just in general before we get started here. I've also worked on parental fees for the last several years. And when parental fees were increased in 2003, 500 people out of the 5,500 that were on it had to immediately drop off that. So it's ironic that we have a series of healthcare access committee meetings, and we need to make, ironic from the standpoint that we really need to make this part of the agenda. I am pessimistic that we're ever going to make substantial progress on parental fees until it becomes part of the governor's budget, and that has to be part of the strategy as we move forward in order to get it. And it's also ironic that it would only take a couple of million dollars to really have a major impact on reducing those fees for parents. So I'm supportive of any legislation that comes up that would reduce parental fees, because we hear from parents all the time that are in the same situation that the Trahan family is that they've had to drop services because they could no longer pay the fee, and in addition to that are paying their back bill to the Department of Human Services for several thousand dollars, if not more than that. What I wanted to talk about today, and I really appreciate the wealth of information that all the speakers and before me shared, is a little different perspective. And my perspective is that we need to turn the system on its head, that we need to empower consumers to have control over the resources that are available to them. And until we do that, we could make substantial changes in a number of the items that we talked about here, but not make a whole lot of progress on the daily impact that consumers have. The Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities has had a comprehensive list of legislation that we've been advocating for several years, and it addresses many of these issues, and we'll be working with this committee and other legislators to advance many of those topics in this upcoming 2008 legislative session. But we need to be focused on how to provide the opportunity for individuals with disabilities to have control over those resources available to them. Because if we don't, we'll continue to perpetuate poverty for persons with disabilities. They'll continue to remain isolated in their communities, lack real friendships and relationships, and lack the disposable income that real employment will bring them. What we have right now is a system that is a provider-driven system. In other words, they control the dollars. And there are many good providers out there, so this isn't a comment on that. But it is a comment on who controls those dollars and what services you're getting. So we do need to empower individuals with disabilities. And I apologize, I have a handout here that I'm just going to reference real quickly. And one of the things in our self-determination principles is, and I'm just going to share a couple of quotes and then go into my suggestions for changes, is the ability to control a targeted amount of public dollars together with private money in order to craft a life plan that results in everyday freedoms that all Americans desire. That's one of the goals of self-determination. Individuals have to have control over those resources. So what are we talking about? We're talking about some programs that already existed. At one point in time, 3,000 Minnesotans on the Developmental Disabilities Waiver were on a program called Consumer Directed Community Support. Because of tightening budgets and other issues, that's dropped down to 1,300 individuals. We need to expand that option and make it available to all individuals. Even though through statute that service is now available on all of our waiver programs, there's only been 100 or 200 additional people that have gone on the elderly waiver, CADI and CAC, because of the restrictions in the funding for it. So we need to fix that. In this past legislative session, this past spring, we passed the self-directed supports option, 1915J. It's a major step in the right direction in empowering individuals with disabilities. And this would allow individuals that are just on medical assistance, perhaps they're waiting for a waiver slot or to get on one of the waiver programs, to have control over their resources through that they're allocated through their PCA or home care assessment. And we're working on a statewide committee right now to implement that, and that could benefit several thousand people. We need to make these options available for all persons with disabilities that are on public programs to have control over those resources so that they can define what their life goals are and build a life. Instead of just perpetuating the service system that we have that takes care of folks, we need to have people achieve their individual outcomes, build a life, and become as self-sufficient as possible. So we need to expand those options. We need to develop a system that promotes and allows persons with disabilities to build equity. And we can do that in a number of ways, and we have specific legislation that can help with that. But right now, most housing that people with disabilities live in is owned by someone else, or controlled certainly by someone else, as we just heard from the last testimony. We need to turn that around so that individuals with disabilities are building equity so that government dollars aren't constantly being put into the system and not building equity for persons with disabilities, because we have the ironic situation that we're spending billions of dollars to support persons with disabilities and yet they remain impoverished. It doesn't make sense. So we need to work on that. We need to free up the group residential housing dollars, which are state-only dollars, so that they can be provided in non-licensed settings. And we need to work on that as part of our legislation in 2008, and that will be one of our priorities. We already talked extensively about employment, and we certainly need to move in that direction. The other area is we need to develop a quality assurance system that's based on achieving the outcomes that individuals with disabilities want. We've taken some initial steps with some of the legislation that passed this spring, but that was only the start of that, and we need to build a comprehensive system so that we know what people want, we can remedy situations that aren't working correctly and do it in a systematic manner. So I'm here to say that the ARC of Minnesota, as well as the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, will continue to push for a consumer-directed system in which individuals with disabilities have control over their dollars, so that if they have control, they can purchase the supports they need. It might be transportation supports, it might be employment supports or whatever, if they have greater flexibility to do this as we move into the future and design a system, we're going to systematically attack and hopefully overcome many of the issues that were discussed today. Thank you very much for your time. Did I make it by noon?
Just about, but so that is just fine. Are there any questions? Yes, Mr. Anderson. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Larson, you want to have group homes without having licensed having them have to be licensed by the state. That's why I'm hearing what you're saying.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, what we want to do is free up the dollars that pay for room and board in those group homes so that those dollars would follow individuals if they were currently living in a group home. So, for instance, you have a four-bed supervised living situation right now, and group residential housing dollars they're paying for that. If one of those individuals wants to move out into their own apartment, those room and board or group residential housing dollars cannot follow them to that apartment.
Mm. Okay.
And so this would create more flexibility. So we're working on that. It was part of our legislation that we didn't get funded this past year for a modest cost of $900,000 over the biennium. So we'll be bringing that up again this year to create some flexibility there.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
No? No? Well,
thank you so much, Mr. Larson, and thank you for wrapping us up. I think this has been a very interesting hearing here. We've had a lot of information, and I think it's given us all something to think about. And I just want to go back to what we heard at the beginning with Judge Frank saying, you know, equal justice under the law. Well, one of the things that we have as our first sentence is the pursuit of happiness. And I didn't hear a whole lot of happiness here this morning. So I would like to hope that we are able to think about that in the upcoming session and the sessions that follow to bring some joy to some people's lives by making some very small changes. So thank you all for coming today, and I wish you all a happy holiday season. And our next meeting will be on transportation, and right now we're trying to schedule this. We'd like to hold it after session starts so that we can have a full committee. We don't have a date and time yet for that because we're waiting to see how the committee schedules work out the first couple weeks, but I'm imagining it will be within the first 2 weeks of session starting. So we'll be putting that out on the listserv. Watch for that. Thank you all for coming. Meeting is adjourned.